All right, now, everybody, listen up. Now, we're obviously not getting to enough people because look at our numbers tonight. There should be twice as many of us here. We're getting too sloppy. That's all there is to it. Now, their detection is becoming more effective. So we have to be more careful. Stay aware of keeping up appearances. Go to work. Punch your time clocks. Do what's expected of you. We've gotten reckless. And the movement's suffering for it.
Time to stop talking about it. Trying to figure out how it happened. Now we start spilling some blood.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. It's not working. We don't stand a chance with a few guns and grenades.
So what are we supposed to do?
We bide our time. We seek out and locate their signal and shut it off. Wake people up!
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Good Friday, not the BCFM politics show, on Friday, the 15th of April, 2022. Spring definitely with us, certainly here in Bristol today. And we're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with military-grade psychological warfare, propaganda. And remember that medical misinformation where tens of thousands of Brits died unnecessarily, like an open wound, now apparently that's all forgotten. Transmitter and printing press owners hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for their readers, listeners and viewers as the wealth divide turns into a chasm, herding, if they can, tens of millions of trusting Brits into Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse. Instead, lamenting us calmly, for the most part, through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and into World War III, maybe, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So, today, who has been hacking the Welsh elections? Neil McAvoy explains he's reported it all to the police. His computer's being hacked. He's the leader of the Propel Party. They've got many candidates standing in the elections in hoping to challenge the duopoly between Plaid Cymru and Labour over in Wales. But, oh dear, no. Hack, hack, hack. Who's doing it? Could it be the Russians? And also the Rwanda migrants. This great new policy, supposedly great. Anyway, this is the idea, to reveal policies like this just before Easter, so everyone's chit-chatting about it all over Easter. Oh, aren't the Conservatives wonderful, slapping each other on the back and saying what a brilliant idea it is that we can ship Rwanda, all these various migrants coming across the channel, stick them in airliners and send them over to Rwanda. And that is supposed to be a policy. Diesel stolen from the Royal Navy ship. That was last week's story. I missed, I'm afraid. I just didn't get that one together last week. Something like 12 or 15 tanker loads of diesel stolen from a Royal Navy ship in Devonport dockyards. Criminals just driving in, pumping out the stuff and driving out again without being checked. And also, we take a little look at the ULEZ here in Bristol, which is coming in July. And Elon Musk trying to take over Twitter. What is going on with Twitter? Everyone being suspended, booted off. Even Martin was just telling me Pepe Escobar, one of the greatest journalists in the world, told, no, Twitter is no longer for you, chum. Off you go. Scott Ritter being suspended, brought back and then booted off again. A little bit like the Chinese government saying, oh, we're not going to have a lockdown for this latest outbreak of Omicron over here in Shanghai. And then the next day changing their mind, locking the whole place down for weeks. So, obviously, the leaders don't really know what they're doing half the time. They're taking advice from people here, there and everywhere, and actually not really capable of making their own decisions, in my mind. In part two, the Moscow, this is the Moskva, the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet, is sunk. But the question is, and we'll be examining this very closely, who sunk it? It clearly wasn't some little Ukrainian with a rifle or even a... Well, I mean, it'd take quite a lot to sink one of these things. Looking at the possibility, possibly it was a submarine that sunk it. And also, Sweden and Finland threatened to join NATO. What would that mean for East-West tension? Obviously, that would make it go up. But what's in it for the Swedes? What's in it for the Finns? Anything? And also, we look at NATO weapons making their way into Ukraine, and also possibly mercenaries too. Cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia. Iranian and Russian news now cancelled by the telecoms cartel. And Ofcom too, but not cancelled here. So, Martin Summers, let's just look to begin with at this story to do with the Welsh elections, because we keep hearing, don't we, in this sort of propagandistic way, and maybe, you know, there's a method to their madness, that the Russians have been hacking this and hacking that, hacking the elections, hacking the Brexit vote, things like that, and now some very real hacking going on over in Wales. So what do you think's the psychology behind these stories about election hacking?
Well, I obviously don't know what these specific allegations that McAvoy's making are. I presume we're going to hear that in a minute. Well, the whole concept of hacking elections is essentially a bizarre one, isn't it? The elections, and if you've got electronic voting like in the United States, then the possibility of hacking definitely emerges, although they've got electronic voting in Venezuela where they also print a paper ballot. So, you know, the question of hacking elections only, it was basically a talking point put up by the CIA in order to explain why Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election to Trump, even though, of course, she got more votes. It's an American system. She should have won if it was a different country. But, of course, she didn't win because Trump beat her in the Electoral College, and the Democrats then decided it was to do with hacking by the Russians, which is absurd. But there you go. We're all still talking about it years later, and everybody thinks it's a thing.
Well, I mean, we know it very, very well in the United States and here now, which is these two major political parties. Effectively, it's like a duopoly.
Well, that's true, but the term hacking is a computer term. And, of course, in relation to what was going on in the US, it was the belief that the Russian Secret Service had hacked the Democrats' national computer and then leaked all of these emails about how the primaries have been rigged in favour of Clinton. Now, in actual fact, nobody's disputed that the emails were correct. And in fact, the primaries were rigged in favour of Clinton. If you think if you've got a duopoly system, that's very serious. It means that the people who are trying to choose who should be the candidate didn't get a fair say. But they immediately pointed the finger at Russia and said that Russia had hacked out the information from the computer. Although it looks as if Seth Rich, who was actually in charge of the computer, was the one who leaked it. And he was subsequently murdered in a series under very strange circumstances. Now, the whole concept of hacking of elections comes from that. And, of course, it's completely fraudulent. The emails were correct, no matter how, if the Russians had hacked it out and put them out there, that would have been a perfectly legitimate thing for them to do in any case. But in any case, the Russians said it's nothing to do with us. And, of course, it's turned into this whole thing of Russians hacking elections, which is an absurdity if you think about it. And in many parts of the world, people just don't take this stuff seriously. Elections are rigged, but they're not rigged by the Russians, are they?
Well, we heard, didn't we, from John Shipton, Julian Assange's father, Martin, that this actually is the favoured method of all sorts of powerful forces in the world, superpowers, etc., because through the Vault 7 leak, we now know that it's perfectly feasible to hack into a whole system, whether it be a national system, it could even be a defence system, and leave tracks as if it was one side in the battle, where actually it was the other side in the battle, which is quite worrying, especially since NATO have made it clear that if there is a cyber attack by the Russians or Chinese or whatever, they will consider it as possible to have a military direct response to that.
Yes, but I still come back to the fundamental point in relation to what happened in the US. The emails were genuine. And the rigging was being done by the Democrat National Committee, who were basically calling meetings and making sure that the result was the one they wanted, and people's choices were being undermined, not by the Russians, by the Democrats, by the Democrat Party machine. And in a first-past-the-post, winner-takes-all system, the rigging of the internal elections in the two allowed parties is an extremely serious matter, because it means that the state is basically rigging the outcomes. And, of course, this is all covered up by all this stuff about electronic hacking and so on. I mean, most of the time, yes, of course, hacking is going on. The question is, what relevance is it to a paper ballot election, provided that it's all being conducted above board? And, of course, it isn't conducted above board, and that's the real story.
OK, so I'm just going to try and bring up this piece by Neil McAvoy now, having a few technical troubles. But the position over in Wales, Martin, with Plaid Cymru and Labour, is that basically they are in each... You know, we've heard from Neil before that there is really no choice for the voters. And I suppose that makes you've got serious problems there if Plaid Cymru are sitting down with Labour, making up decisions about most of their major spending decisions, and really what's left for the public, facilitated by the media, is almost like a theatre show.
Well, don't forget that the Tories have still got substantial vote in Wales, and they're excluded from this setup. Of course, they don't have a substantial vote in Scotland at all. It's just gone completely. And the other thing is that Plaid Cymru and Labour generally have much the same policies, apart from on independence. So it's not surprising that they tend to agree about stuff. And in Wales, in local, in the assembly elections, although not in the local elections that we're going to have in May, there's actually a proportional system which gives outside parties like Propulsion, is it called, a chance of establishing themselves. Totally impossible in first past the post in Westminster and in Washington.
Okay, well, let's try and go over to Neil McEvoy now.
If you look at the difference between England and Wales, in England, politicians party, they get fined. In Wales, our politicians were partying, no fines. They said they've done nothing wrong. Welcome back, guys. The broadcast was cut just then. Lobbying rules. In England, an MP breaks the rules, he resigns. In Wales, there are no rules on lobbyists. For those of you who don't know what a lobbyist is, if you want to change a government policy, if you want money off the Welsh government, you go to a lobbying firm, you pay them money, they will make your case to a decision maker. Okay? That's what lobbyists do. Those of us who speak out about things which are very wrong in Welsh politics, they try to crush us, okay? There was a report out about me in March, which the BBC ran with, and complete and utter nonsense. The report was ready in September, okay? It was ready in September, and you see the abuse of power, whereby the report was held back until March, just before the election. Propel was set up to take on the establishment, to rattle some cages, as an elector on the doorstep said to me today. We're anti-corruption. We want to change the status quo. And the result of that is people like me get targeted. There are two council candidates, one in Plaid, one in Labour, who about whom I've made complaints to the police. I'm not even going to name them. One of them is the Radda candidate for Plaid, who photographed the child protection file and kept the images on his phone. The other is a Labour Canton candidate who, I mean, people send me through messages, and it's quite despicable sometimes just to see the lies they write. So I refer those matters to the police. Things have been stepped up recently with my windows being shot out. And I made a post this morning because the last couple of days I've been tied up with the police again and with Action for Fraud. So that'll give you a clue with what is happening. And I'd like to thank the IT specialists who've helped me out and who have improved my security. And made me aware, actually, about how vulnerable you can be online. And essentially, my personal computer has been hacked into. And the only thing which has been messed with is the election data. Okay? So those of you who live in Fairwater, somebody has gone into my personal computer. They've looked at the electoral register, which is, it's a public document anyway, and they've looked at what people vote, and then they then corrupted that data, so it's useless to us. So, for example, in Fairwater now, according to our spreadsheets, nearly everybody votes Propel. It was that blatant. Over a period, they were clearly taking time, and I was wondering if we were making mistakes with the data input in, and it seems now that somebody who's pretty clever, and they were playing a game, I would say, in altering data, deleting data, and ultimately now driving a coach and horses through the data. A lot of it was backed up, so we'll deal with it. But I'm actually surprised that they would go to that level. It's criminal. I hope they've left the footprint. I really do. Because that is being looked at. If they know what they're doing, they can get away with it without using a footprint. I'm going to do a video at some point on data security now and how all of us out there can improve our home security, because I'm in a sickening situation where I have my laptop on and I've been having conversations with my wife, as we all do, and the vermin who, I do say the word vermin, who broke into my computer may well have been listening to our family conversations, listening to me.
So that's Neil McAvoy there. Pretty shocking, Martin. The police looking into this now over in South Wales, although, of course, Neil has been doing quite a lot of work looking into the South Wales police himself. But this is clearly not the Russians. It's a powerful force of some kind. This is deadly serious. This is the beginning of a new party, which is actually doing very well over in Wales, certainly in getting candidates to come forward and stand for them. Their policies are generally sort of Corbyn-esque, Corbynista-type policies, where, in fact, in that video, which I'll put a link to up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, he goes into quite a lot of detail of exactly what they want to do over there, which is to restore things like public services. He's got all sorts of innovative ideas to raise money for local authorities, even if central government doesn't want to fund them. There's things that they can do. A lot of things like council house building. This is potentially a very popular party, which is being, it seems, stymied at birth by hackers.
Well, some years ago now, before the modern era, the Labour Party headquarters in Millbank Tower, somebody broke in and stole all the hard drives of their electoral campaign. And they didn't complain about it because they knew who it was MI5. But they didn't dare complain about it, because if you complained about it, then it looks as if you are somehow a traitor or to be seen as an unreliable element if we accuse the security services of doing it. So all these Labour MPs, Peter Hain was one of the few that actually said, well, we should have complained about that. But the rest of them, oh, no, we don't dare to complain. And you get to the point where the mainstream parties, if you were to say, well, we can't put up with this, you'd be ostracised. Now, with smaller new parties that are emerging, then, of course, they can be the target of this kind of campaign. And don't forget that because all ballots are numbered, those who vote for subversive parties, and we're talking about paper ballots now, have always been, a list has always been made by MI5 of those people. And that includes people who vote for the Communist Party, for example, or for Sinn Féin. They want the lists of who the supporters are. They generally go for A, list of supporters, and B, where are they financed? That's the sort of thing that they want to find out. But that is not, they're not just finding stuff out, they're also intervening and interfering. I don't know who's broken into his computer there. That's his allegation. The police are looking into it. It's likely that it is probably the state. That's the most likely explanation there, isn't it?
Or it could be, of course, some of the private interests, financial interests, who pay a lot of these very powerful lobbyists in Cardiff to make sure that their policies get implemented. I mean, these, you know,
yeah,
I think
it could be, but there's often an overlap between what you might call corporate malfeasance and state malfeasance. The state, in theory, should not be beholden to corporate interests, but often it is. And, you know, there are times when they want to use the state to do things, and there are times when they just farm that out to the private sector. But, of course, with state support, like all of these mercenaries that are ending up in the Ukraine, they're supposedly all private individuals, ex-military, most of them, but the state is encouraging them to go and giving them every assistance.
Okay, so let's have a look at the one of the main stories of this week. That I think should be. I mean, you know, to me, as a journalist and as an editor, the idea that a small up and coming political party has had its computers hacked is, you know, this is Watergate almost. It's that sort of level of crime.
Watergate was just...
I mean, it's criminal these days, you see, Martin, on so many different levels. It's not only the hacking is criminal, but it's also violating election law. So whoever's doing it, you know, let's just hope that South Wales Police get somewhere in pursuing that crime, and it's not covered up by the Chief Constable, as quite a lot of crimes have been in South Wales. Another major story this week involving the police was on Wednesday night on Newsnight, and I don't normally bother watching Newsnight, but it had been trailed a bit beforehand. It was a very, very powerful story, again, about problems with the police. In this case, in the year or so running up to the Manchester Arena bombings, problems with the computer systems that have been being used by the cops there. What do you make of this, Martin? I don't know, have you seen the story yourself about the... No. It was Richard Watson's report on Newsnight. Have you seen anything of it yet, Martin?
No.
Okay. Right. Well, you can have a listen now, because it is deadly serious stuff. So the intelligence services, that is MI5, Special Branch, and the Anti-Terror Branch, they use a particular type of software which was implemented in Manchester about a year before the Manchester Arena bombings, which the people who were using it had been constantly saying, it's just not working, this thing, and yet they implemented it anyway. So it could have potentially been a major factor that allowed the bombing to take place. So let's have a listen now to the full report. It's around about 7 minutes long, by Richard Watson, where he speaks to the Special Branch, the Anti-Terror Branch whistleblower, police officer Tony Thorpe, who resigned, I think, in 2018, just after the terror attacks, which were just before the general election in 2017.
It's called the National Common Intelligence Application, NCIA, and it had been deployed to the northwest of England by early 2017, before the Manchester Arena bombings. So could the problems we're going to reveal tonight have contributed to the failure to stop the attack? We can't be sure, but a well-placed source told me that the performance of counter-terrorism police IT systems was a significant weakness at that time.
Okay, Richard. Abby?
Yes. We've also spoken to this former counter-terrorism police officer who's decided to go public with his concerns.
Well, the idea was to have one pot of intelligence. To have it in one area is a fantastic thing. Not on paperwork, you can't get lost, it's there, it backs up. It was a way forward. But from the very start, the application itself was just not fit for purpose.
In 2013, the police launched a pilot project in Scotland to develop the NCIA system. Tony Thorne spent 6 months on the pilot, but just weeks in, he says there were serious problems.
It was a sort of training operation where we had everything running live out in the streets as well. And we set up a proper sort of operation cell. And we were trying to give in sort of, they call it live feeds all the time to make this operation as work as realistic as possible. I don't think we got past, I think, second or third feed before it just fell apart.
In what way did it fall apart?
Just couldn't get the information out to people, couldn't record the information, couldn't store it. People just couldn't access the system. They were just sort of, it's clunky, it was clumsy, it was complicated, it was not user-friendly.
Worse than that, he says he found it was producing different results for identical searches by officers sat side by side.
They were watched and they came out with different data. So the bio details that were coming back were completely different, or there was, instead of having 10 reports coming back, there was 5. There's something wrong there.
And he found the system could lead to vital intelligence being lost.
So I took a report that had been written, I was able to go in and edit it, and it couldn't be unedited. So it basically, that report was lost. So what was in there, it was lost. And I said, well, you should be locked down. You shouldn't be able to do that.
So you were finding evidence that actually some data could just be destroyed?
Yeah. Just written over.
Tony warned his bosses in 2014 that the system wasn't ready. But it was deployed to Scotland and other forces, including in the northwest of England.
They had the chance to put it on hold, to stop, because we had a system there that was working. And we knew it worked because we had arrested people. We had Operation Guava, so it did work.
So it was too early to be rolled out?
Oh, 100%. Rolled out too quickly. It should never have gone out.
Delays meant the Met Police didn't get it in London until 2019. But this police document shows it was rolled out in the northwest 2 years earlier, before the Manchester Arena bombing. So could the flaws that Tony had been warning about since 2014 have been contributory factors to the failure to stop the attack? What did you feel when you woke up that morning in 2017 and heard there'd been a really severe bomb attack in Manchester?
Deep down, physically sick. I could 100% say, yes, NCIA was the cause of it, but it'd be a factor to it. And not just the system itself, the management of it, the training of people to use it, the usability.
A government spokesperson told us,
"It is a matter for the chair of the Manchester Arena inquiry to decide whether the systems counter-terrorism policing used impacted their ability to prevent the attack."
Adding that NCIA greatly enhanced counter-terrorism work in the years after the Manchester attack. Counter-terrorism policing, the body that oversees the work of counter-terrorism units across Britain, told us that substantial improvements were made following a significant review after the spate of attacks in 2017. It didn't deny our evidence that there were significant problems before this, but said after 2017,
32 late-stage terror attacks have been disrupted and saved many lives.
Adding that
NCIA has been an essential tool in helping us achieve this.
And it denied that warnings about flaws had been ignored. Tony Thorne left the police in 2018, a few years early on grounds of ill health. But the thought that the NCIA problems he'd warned about 4 years earlier could have hampered counter-terrorism investigations still haunts him.
8 years I've been trying to bring this issue to the surface. And I've gone to some big people. I've gone to Priti Patel. I've gone to the Home Office. You know, I've wrote in there and I put, you know, sort of CC'd in my letters and my emails to Boris Johnson and other professional standards departments throughout the country to say, look, you know, Manchester Police, I even copied them into it. And not a reply of anybody except for the Home Office, who sent a letter and said, I need to, if I've got any issues, I need to go back to my professional standards department.
So no one's actually addressed the substantive points you're raising?
None at all.
Safi Roussos's father, for one, is grateful for Tony's decision to speak out.
I want to give him a hug. I want to shake his hand. Because this is, I commend people that will come forward and say, do you know what, guys, this is wrong.
You said some very strong words in the inquiry about a huge intelligence failure. Do you stand behind that now?
Oh, 100%, yes, absolutely. You know, I'll be the first to say, we can't stop every terrorist attack. We can't, and I don't expect them to, because, you know, these people work in dark places. But we can't stop the ones that flag a white flag on front of your office windows for many, many years.
Safi!
We can't stop everything. But please stop the ones that wave at you.
Yeah, please stop the ones that wave at you. What he's saying here is this guy, Martin Salman Abedi, was absolutely on the radar of all the intelligence services. He lost his daughter in the attacks. And I'm looking at Tony Thorne there. He's p- particularly annoyed because he spent 8 years saying, well, look, this piece of software isn't actually any use for us police officers. And it seems that we've got a whole bunch of ostriches, both at the Home Office, the Cabinet Office, in the police services right across the country, all saying, well, nothing to do with me, mate.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are no different levels to this story, isn't there? There's the ostensible level of the failure of a computer system, which will be to do with institutional failures, who was subcontracted to provide it, all of that sort of stuff. And then there's the bigger question of the Manchester bombs itself. And of course, Salman Abedi was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which has been based in Manchester since the 1980s and has been working hand in glove with our intelligence services to overthrow Gaddafi.
If I can just pick out two specific things. One is the locals said several of them had reported Salman Abedi to the anti-terror hotline in the months running up to the attack. And the other is that the police complained that they were kept away from the scene of the attack for nearly an hour, even though all these, the fire brigade were kept away for nearly an hour to the actual scene of the attack, even though they were all first aid trained and this sort of thing. So they could have been helping save lives, but they were told by the police, no, you're not allowed in.
Well, the police at the time, I understand what the police were saying about that. We thought there might be a follow-on shooter. But I think there's a much deeper question here.
You remind me of the attack on the Houses of Parliament, where they said the same thing, that no one was allowed to go anywhere because there was a second shooter. There wasn't. It was just a lie.
I know, but I mean, that could just be a mistake. But it's certainly not a mistake that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was based in Manchester. And they've been going backwards and forwards to Libya. Abedi had just flown back from Libya, where he'd been cooperating with other members of his family in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who were cooperating with MI6 and the SAS to overthrow Gaddafi. And they were being tolerated, not just tolerated, patronised in Manchester. And the very least you can say is that they shouldn't have been in bed with these people. But of course, the worst is that they may be behind the attack. And that, of course, is a very serious matter and quite likely the case. Don't forget, the timing of the attack was in the middle of an election campaign and therefore supposedly put Jeremy Corbyn on the back foot. What's he going to say about this terrible terrorist attack? And what he said was, this is a terrible terrorist attack, but we've got to confront the fact that our invasions of other countries have created the circumstances where this is the sort of thing that will happen. And that actually went down rather well. They thought that it would put him on the spot, but in actual fact it didn't, because he played a straight bat with it. But you can imagine if they did plot the attack, that would be what they wanted to happen. Same with the Madrid train bomb.
What might be the point of having a terrorist attack, whether this is organised by the deep state or whether it's organised by some lone wolf, which I very much doubt, but what's the point of...
He's a member of the Libyan Islamic...
Well, no, but of course, to begin with, we're always told this, aren't we? The main headline's always, lone wolf, like Brenton Tarrant, who was the guy who murdered those 50 or so Muslims in Christchurch. And then you look a little bit deeper, you find actually he's part of a much wider network of neo-Nazis and Nazi maniacs. So, but what's the point of having terrorist attacks in the run-up to an election? Is it likely to actually steer the way the election is perceived or anything?
Yes. If the deep state are behind these things, and I believe they are, like the 9/11 attack, for example, or the Bologna bombing, the reason they do it is because it has results from their point of view. That's why they do it. Now, of course, we've got to keep the logical possibility open that they could have stopped, they just messed up here. The way they messed up was by playing around with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group anyway. If I was a relative of somebody who'd been killed there, that's the question I'd be asking. Why Salman Abedi had been going to Libya under the auspices of our own intelligence services to fight Gaddafi. And then he comes back and blows himself up. You could say, well, that's really silly of us to encourage people like that. But of course, it's worse than that. It could very well be that this, like many other terrorist attacks, is actually coming about the deep state using the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group as cover. Although, of course, the father of Abedi said from Libya, this is MI6 that has done this. They've created this situation. And, of course, that was all airbrushed from our media. He eventually turned up in Turkey, I understand.
Well, the main point, really, I suppose, of the report by Richard Watson, brilliant report on Newsnight this week, was the problem is that this system is still there. It means that Britain is extremely vulnerable to a terrorist attack and to active terrorism cells because the police aren't able to actually track them properly. And now, as it's been on the television, everyone knows that. It's quite clear. Okay, to what extent do you think this is incompetence and to what extent is it deliberate?
Well, the stuff about the computer system, it sounds very similar to what's happened in other parts of the public sector with computer systems. Think about Test and Trace and Dido Hardy.
A contract awarded to somebody that's absolutely not up to the job.
Right.
Maybe a
that's
mate
right.
of the people who are doing the awarding of the contracts.
Yes, so there's that level of it. But I think more fundamental in this particular case is that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was an integral part of MI6's strategy to overthrow Gaddafi. When Dave Shaler and Annie Machong blew the whistle on MI6's assassination attempt on Gaddafi, the medium for that was the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group based in Manchester. There's loads of them there. They've been going backwards. They've been intimate with our intelligence services going back to the 1980s and Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan. Now, that's what people need to focus on. Why are these people here at all?
I mean, is it some sort of terrorist incubator?
Yeah, well, the point is that you could argue that they've been very silly about this and they've spent years and years and years cultivating these Islamist militants to overthrow the Red Army in Afghanistan, to overthrow Assad, etc. And in actual fact, these are the wrong kind of people and the blowback is that they then turn around and kill you. But it's worse than that because they're actually intimate with these groups. They direct these groups. And they, therefore, have to be suspects for causing the Manchester Arena bombing. And the purpose of the bombing, from the deep state's point of view, would be to try and destabilise Jeremy Corbyn's bid to be prime minister on a slide of blood.
No, that's right. Well, there were three terrorist attacks, weren't there, in the run-up to that 2017 election?
All often.
There was just run through them. Manchester, we had the one I just mentioned, the attack on Westminster Bridge on the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah,
where
there was no CCTV
ran his 4x4 into the Houses of Parliament. And also the London Bridge attacks, where one of the attackers had actually been on a Channel 4 documentary a few months previously, showing his prowess as a Islamist terrorist. So, look, I mean, this is madness. But what I'm trying to get at here, Martin, is just this whole business of the way that these terrorist attacks can completely dominate the narrative in the two weeks or so in the run-up to a very important vote, like a general election.
Yes, and that will be the motive behind the people doing it. In Madrid, in the Madrid train bombings, which was in 2003, I think, I can't remember the exact date, there was an election coming up, and these train bombs went off, all of them in socialist voting suburbs of Madrid, killed loads of people, and it was supposed to cement Aznar, who was the Conservative Prime Minister, in power, because he could turn around and say, I invaded Iraq, and look now, this is what's happened, you know, you've got to support me. But in actual fact, 3 million people who didn't normally vote, poorer people and ethnic minorities, came out and voted, and they voted for Zapatero, because the general perception of the Spanish population, don't forget they used to live under Franco, was that it was Aznar's fault for invading Iraq. Therefore, of course, he compounded the error by trying to blame ETA for it.
Anyway.
And it became clear that it was, in fact, not ETA. It was Islamist extremists who all died very mysteriously.
It came out,
and
didn't it?
In fact, when you look at the biography of those extremists, they all turned out to be petty criminals.
It came out a couple of months ago, Martin, didn't it? From the French intelligence, former French intelligence officer, blew the whistle, a police officer blew the whistle, saying...
Catalan intelligence officer, Spanish intelligence.
Saying that actually we carried out a certain terrorist attack. So this is the intelligence services in Spain actually admitting that they carry these terrorist attacks out. This is something which is...
This was in Catalonia in the run-up to the independence referendum. There was a so-called jihadist attack, which killed quite a lot of people. But the guys had said, well, no, that was actually the Spanish intelligence services doing that to try and subvert the vote that was coming up.
I know, isn't it amazing what this secrecy can do for you? Oh, yeah, we've got to have all this secrecy. We get paid by the public taxpayers' money, but we can't tell you anything about what you do because it's also top secret. And then it comes out, oh, actually, we were just blowing you up.
Well, the biggest underlying factor, there are occasionally some lone wolf terrorists, but virtually all the big stuff, all of it, Bologna Railway Station, 9/11, Piazza Fontana, assassinated Waldo Moro. It kind of goes back decades. It is the Western intelligence services, which is why the Russians react with such a laugh when they're accused of trying to rig elections and engage in cyber warfare.
Okay, so
the people they're up against, they're absolutely ruthless terrorists.
Let's just move on now to look at the fascinating way that the Conservative Party have decided to respond to the migrant crossing of the Channel. It's fair to say that most of it's organised crime that's actually getting these people across here. They're paying large amounts of money. There is a mixture of some asylum seekers and also, of course, economic migrants. But what do you make of this policy, Martin, where they're going to stick them on an aeroplane and send them to Rwanda?
Well, I would not claim that organised crime has some role in it, but a lot of these people literally have made their own way there and are using a rubber dinghy. So you've got to,
Look, let's just be fair here. These are larger than a rubber dinghy, and they usually can take about 30 or 40 people, up to 30 or 40 people.
It is
organised crime. It is organised crime. That is the reason that it hasn't been very easy to stop, because these, as you say and I say, organised crime is well organized.
Yes, but the people, what they could do for the wider issue is they could just process these people in France. This is what the French have been saying: process them. Yeah, and then you can decide which ones you want, which ones you don't.
Well, apparently that's not working. Anyway, let's have a listen now.
It hasn't been tried, Tony.
There is a place that they can go to. It's a long way away from the coast.
They've got to set foot on British soil before they can make an asylum claim in Britain. Now, we could get around that if the British change the rules, but they don't want to change the rules, because that means more of them would come. Most of these people are genuine. We've started all these wars in Libya and Iraq and Syria and all these other places, and the flotsam and jets are turning up on our shores.
I'm not so sure about most of them being genuine, Martin. There's a mixture of both.
Let's put that aside then, Tony.
Let's have a listen to what Boris has got to say then about his wonderful new plan.
Our compassion may be infinite, but our capacity to help people is not. So from today, our new migration and economic development partnership will mean that anyone entering the UK illegally, as well as those who have arrived illegally since January the 1st, may now be relocated to Rwanda. This innovative approach, driven by our shared humanitarian impulse and made possible by Brexit freedoms, will provide safe and legal routes for asylum while disrupting the business model of the gangs. Because it means that economic migrants taking advantage of the asylum system will not get to stay in the UK, while those in genuine need will be properly protected, including with access to legal services on arrival in Rwanda, and given the opportunity to build a new life in that dynamic country, supported by the funding we are providing. The deal we've done is uncapped, and Rwanda will have the capacity to resettle tens of thousands of people in the years ahead. We're confident that our new migration partnership is fully compliant with our international legal obligations. But nevertheless, we expect this will be challenged in the courts. And if this country is seen as a soft touch for illegal migration by some of our partners, it is precisely because we have such a formidable army of politically motivated lawyers who for years have made it their business to thwart removals and frustrate the government. So I know that this system will not take effect overnight, but I promise that we will do whatever it takes to deliver this new approach.
I know that this system will not work. Will it work, Martin? Can it work?
I don't think so. I mean, there's all sorts of things to say about this. As he says, it will be challenged in the courts because it's completely against UN refugee conventions to do something like this. The other question is, where is Rwanda and how free is Rwanda? And in actual fact, the Tutsi-dominated RPF government in Rwanda is very much aligned with the West. And of course, they've got loads of secret prisons, and they're, you know, it's not actually a free country. And that's, of course, people didn't want to go there. people want to come to Britain because they want to come to Britain. Now, whether they're entitled to come to Britain or not is has to be decided. But they're not, they're, you know, you're saying, what they're saying is if you've got to go to Rwanda, loads of people won't come. And that's the way to kind of get the Tory base to vote Tory, as opposed to voting UKIP, I suppose. But, it, I mean, it's actually other European countries have far higher proportions of refugees than we do. Our geography allows us to push all the problems to some other people. We were the ones who decided to destroy Libya, but it's the Italians who got to process all the refugees. And, of course, if we're going to rebuild the economy of Rwanda, that will increase massive increases in wealth taxes in this country.
Interesting. I'm
to
sure
make the Rwandan
I'm
economy
sure.
sufficiently prosperous that all these people with their qualifications can be employed. It's
sure,
a joke.
I'm sure you'll you appreciate Boris saying that this is a great use of our Brexit freedoms.
Well, I mean, that's that again is red meat to his Tory base.
Do you think so? Do you think they really think so, that this is some great, wonderful victory post-Brexit? I also remember interviewing Alex Perry, who's was a Newsweek journalist, and he's the author of a book called The Rift, which came out in about 2016, I think, 2017, no, 2017, 2018, where he really does look at the, even in his Newsweek article, the newspaper about 3 weeks later, Newsweek Europe, was closed down after his article exposing the organised crime people behind the Mediterranean and now the Channel systems of getting people. I mean, Martin, as a Labour person, this shouldn't be something, you know, about economic migrants. It shouldn't be just a kind of open and shut issue, as it often is in the Labour Party, because, you know, you've got some people who are coming in just as economic migrants, you know, given you think that they're a minority, but there is a big advantage for the big multinationals, isn't it? That they can take these people as just cheap labour. They can undermine all the pay and conditions that trade unions in Britain have worked for decades.
This issue about economic migration is an important issue. Don't forget that in most European countries, including Britain, the demography, you've got no children, I've got no children. The demography means you've got to have young people to come in and do the work. We're finding that in
well,
all
no,
sorts of
hang on,
sectors.
Hang on, that's
now.
Not what I said at all, is it? I'm
no,
just
no,
saying
you,
that
that's
they're
what
doing,
I said.
They're
you,
doing,
you
that, what they're doing,
said,
what they're doing, what they're doing is they're undermining the, I mean, for example, I was hearing this week that the border force can't recruit people. It's not because there's not enough people that will do the job, it's because they're not paying enough.
Yes, and that implies if it's a public service like the border force that you've got to increase taxes on wealthy people to rebuild the economy of Rwanda and rebuild your border force.
Well, just
we
put,
could
put,
have,
just put the pay up.
Martin,
why don't you just put the pay up? They got all this money, yes, for various wars
could,
and things. They could just pay people
pay
more.
Up, Tony, they should be putting the pay up across the public sector. I work in the public sector. I want my pay put up. But to do that, you've got to increase public expenditure. And that means that the Chancellor of the Exchequer, we haven't really covered the budget stuff this week, but the Chancellor of the Exchequer has either got to print the money or he's got to raise the money by raising taxes on somebody. Now, of course, what's happened in this country since the 1950s...
Well, he can just print the money, can't
...is that the taxes on the wealthy are no longer a viable... We can't tax the wealthy, so we've either got to print money or we've got to cut pay and conditions. And, of course, what we're getting is cutting pay and conditions. Now, people moving around, don't forget it was our governments that decided to invade Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, all these places, and now the cost of that is coming clear, home to us. We've got to pay more people to be in the border force. We're going to have to accommodate new people coming in who have got a legitimate right to come here because they're running away from wars we started. And all of this has got to be dealt with in the context of a global economic crisis and our own security services blowing things up. Just fantastic, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I mean, you're sort of getting away from the point there, which is that the economic migrants just undermine paying conditions for the whole country.
All right, let's come back to that.
This is a basic trade union issue, isn't it? And surely the trade unions, you know, can recognise that unlimited economic migration is very bad for the country. It just means that there's loads of people who will do jobs. I mean, look at the P&O thing, for example. Very good example of a whole bunch of highly skilled people just being undermined by cheap labour.
Well, the problem there is that they shouldn't be allowed to sack those people.
Well, they were. Apparently, they weren't allowed to sack them, but they did it anyway.
Yes,
in fact, the government,
because that wouldn't have happened in the 1970s or in the 1950s.
Well, they could get
the
away with it.
Were more powerful.
They can get away with it. Now it's actually the government. Martin, it's not just the trade unions. It's that the law is not enforced anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's discuss this question of economic migration. As you know, I used to teach A-level economics. Now the actual truth about what happens in this is having all of these highly skilled but quite low paid people coming in from the European Union has boosted economic growth in Britain.
No, it's surely, if it puts people on universal credit in the dole, that means the actual the government has to pay far more for those people.
Why are you going to let me make the argument or not?
Well, no, I'm just putting a counter argument. You're saying this is good for the economy. I'm saying, well, what about all the people who used to be paid a lot but are now on the dole?
Well, that's to do with economic policy by the British government. The objective facts are, and if you check in, you know, I read economic blogs like Simon Wren-Lewis's blog, mainly macro. The economic arguments, and if I was teaching you at A level, I would say you've got to put both sides of the argument. And the other side of the argument is having relatively cheap labour with high skills boosts your economic growth, which means the pie is bigger and everybody can have higher wages, provided the policy is to give people higher wages. The policy in this country has been to drive wages down. Now, I agree that moving people around by big capital can undermine people's wages, but maybe you should oppose big capital's wars, because these people are going to run away anyway. You've got the choice of dying in Libya or cleaning toilets in London. The choice is no choice.
But it may be just that conditions in these countries are so awful that people want to get away. Way to somewhere better, and who can blame them for that? Anyway, let's have a listen now to
for that, and especially if we've made the conditions that they're running away from.
Well, yeah, or maybe the IMF. I mean, maybe the IMF.
Libya was an expanding economy, and they were providing loads of work for people coming in from outside. They didn't go further, but then we smashed it.
Yeah, well, this is one of the main reasons why the migrants were being brought across the Mediterranean, because of the destruction of Libya by Cameron and the rest of them. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Glorious Priti Patel talking about her wonderful new policy. The majority of people arriving in the boats are going to be sent off to Rwanda.
We're very clear that everyone who enters the UK illegally will be considered for resettlement and being brought over to Rwanda. I'm not going to divulge specific criteria for a number of reasons, because quite frankly we are trying to break the model of the people smuggling gangs, who use a range of ways in which to provide facilitation to our country and then obviously provide legal challenges to us as well. But the vast majority, I think it's important to say this, of people that have been arriving to the UK via illegal means such as small boats, via the people smugglers, you know, will obviously be considered to be relocated.
Well, this is her great Easter policy, which is going to keep all those Conservative voters happy over the Easter break, Martin.
Yeah, and of course it defies... people have a right... It's not illegal to come to Britain and claim asylum. She claims it is, but it isn't. Once you've set foot on British soil, you can claim asylum. That's international law. And of course, if you go back to the Granville Sharp case in the 1700s about slavery, he was able to argue that once somebody had set foot on English soil, they were free and could not be enslaved, and the courts upheld it. And of course, Priti Patel herself came here in the 1970s, or her parents did, when Idi Amin kicked the Ugandan Asians out of Uganda, as did Rishi Sunak. But they're both very wealthy and very well connected these days. And it's I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder, isn't it? As a freeborn Brit, and my family probably on both sides have lived in this country for hundreds of years, I feel resentful of that.
Why?
Because my reputation as a freeborn Englishman matters to me. And I don't like other people dragging it through the rubbish.
But I mean, Britain's reputation around the world, Martin, is pretty dodgy now, isn't it? I mean, it's in the gutter, really.
Yes. But despite everything, people do respect it because of people like Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is well-liked and respected all over the world. The only place where people think he's rubbish, or some people think he's rubbish, is in Britain.
Well, we're getting
the
on.
South Africans, the Argentinians, the loads of people, are the people of East Timor, I mean, he's the Kurds. I first met Jeremy Corbyn working on a magazine called Kurdistan Focus. He was the only person to vote against arming Saddam after the Al-Abja massacre.
Well, it seems the only people you know responsible for bigging up the idiots and the you know the dodgy people and character assassinating the good people is the London media.
Yes, well they're another brick in the wall, aren't they? It's getting very, you know, the world is this is the biggest crisis since World War II. And, you know, everybody's...
You mean Ukraine?
Everybody's being sorted into, you know, all sorts of things.
Well, we've been talking about Ukraine in part two, but there's a related story. £250,000 worth of diesel was stolen from HMS Bulwark. Bulwark, which is undergoing a refit in Devonport Dockyards. That is around about 120,000 litres, 30,000 gallons, 7 tanker loads. All of this was just pumped off of the ship into tankers, and they then drove it out of Devonport. Martin, this is a bit of a haul, isn't it? And it was just someone that spotted something suspicious that ordered that the this tanker be stopped on the way out and checked. It was the only reason they found it. Otherwise, they probably would have got away with more of it. So this is around about £250,000 worth of diesel just gone from the top secret, high security Royal Navy dockyards.
Yes, well, of course, diesel is becoming an absolutely crucial commodity. William Engdahl's got a good piece on New Eastern Outlook this week about this, because, of course, by cutting off Russian diesel, basically the Western economy, you know, diesel is is absolutely essential to the functioning of Western economies. I mean, I haven't got a diesel car, but things like trains, transport, all of that is run on diesel. And surprisingly enough, the US have waived sanctions on Russian diesel, and they're actually buying more Russian diesel. Meanwhile, we in Western Europe and Eastern Europe are going to cut off our own noses to spite our own faces, and we're not going to buy Russian diesel anymore, which means, of course, that our economy will crash while the US economy will continue to prosper until it crashes as a subsequent result. This is where we're at now.
It's yeah, but absurd. You, course, Martin, you're always criminal. Talking about crashes. Surely what happens is actually the people who should collapse and crash just get bailed out.
Yeah, but there's a limit to the bailing out, Tony. The limit is the gold-backed ruble. They can only do this money printing because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. As soon as it isn't, the economy in the US will implode.
Well, okay, let's have a brief look at that, because the ruble for a brief period of time is now backed by gold. What's the significance of that?
Well, if you go back to 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, they created a whole new system, really.
Hang on, let's just be a bit clearer there. In the 70s, Nixon, the dollar was pegged to gold. In other words, that you could exchange a dollar for gold. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then that's he decided right. that this wasn't such a good idea. And actually, they were just bits of paper and entries in ledgers. So we didn't really need to pin it to gold anymore. How and why did that happen?
Well, the reason he did it is because he wanted to carry out social reforms inside the not him, but the previous incumbent Johnson had wanted to carry out social reforms inside the US, but they didn't want to give up the Vietnam War. And it's what's called the Triffin dilemma, after the economist Triffin, who pointed out that you can either have a reserve currency, the dollar is a reserve currency, or you can have and if you do that, then you're going to have massive budget and trade deficits. Now, they've had massive budget and trade deficits for years, but they've been able to finance it because everybody else has to buy dollars and they just print them. Now, what's happening now with what's happened over Ukraine and the Russian steps that they're taking, and there's still some question about how this is going to work, is that there's going to be two economic systems. There's going to be it won't just be a ruble-based system, but it will be a non-US dollar system, and it will be linked to energy.
Well, what are the reasons why somebody...
Just as the dollar is.
Martin, what are the reasons why some country, such as, for example, China, that trades both with China and the United States, might choose a gold-backed ruble rather than a dollar?
Well, you can't just... The dollar isn't going to die immediately. It's just the writing on the wall. An alternative system is currently being born. There's a bit of a struggle going on in Russia between Sergei Glazyev, who's a left-wing economist that I've been aware of since the 90s when I went to Russia, and I can't remember her name, she's a female who runs the central bank, and she basically is part of the central banking cartel, and Glazyev is gunning for her. He's been put in charge of developing this new strategy, but she's in the way. And she basically has been dragging her heels about getting it all up and running, because, you know, she's got a conventional economic background and she thinks we've got to have dollars, otherwise we won't be able to trade. But it's ridiculous, because all the dollars that even private individuals were holding in Western banks had just been confiscated, just as Venezuela's gold was confiscated by the Bank of England. And eventually all these people are going to realise we can't put our money in your banks because you're going to take it off us. And therefore an alternative system of payments is already being cobbled together. The Indians have decided that they're going to buy Russian oil in ruble what's their currency? I can't remember now. Then the point is that the world at large isn't going along with this sanctions stuff, and that is going to set up two mutually hostile systems.
Okay, so her name is Elvira Nebulina. She's 58 years old, the boss of the Russian Central Bank. Stories a few weeks ago that she had offered her resignation.
Well, that's right, but Putin refused to let her go. I think what he wants to do is, because she's got a reputation as being a sort of pro-American fiscal hawk, he wants to keep her there as a kind of cover for what they really want to do. And if she resigned, then he'd have to put Glazer in and everybody would know what the game was.
It's difficult to know what's going on, because there are headlines saying that she has resigned.
There are struggles going on.
There are some headlines, Martin, saying she has resigned. So, you know, we're getting lots of...
If she resigns and Glazer gets the job, he's definitely pushing.
Anyway,
that we've got to set up an alternative world currency based on commodities and people's local currencies. And we've just got to get away from the dollar. But the problem for the US is... they cannot fund their hundreds of bases around the world unless they've got the free dollar. And if they can't, linked to selling oil in dollars. But the Saudis are talking to the Chinese about selling their oil for yuan. Now, they may be overthrown as a result of that. So, you know, it's getting very, very interesting. They're refusing to take phone calls. Both the UAE and Saudi are refusing to take phone calls from Biden. And this is all knock-on effects of what's happening in the Ukraine.
Ah, well, your article that you mentioned, the headline, I'll put a link up to it on our show page. Very good article it is too, as usual, from William Engdahl. I mean, he is really, I think, isn't he half Russian, half German or something?
No, I think he's German-American, isn't he?
But he speaks Russian anyway, so yeah. He's analysis of diesel is fascinating. He sees it as really one of the most important commodities on the planet, and also that there is a genuine shortage now. If Russia is cut out of these systems this year, then the world simply will not be able to function properly. He winds up though, Martin, by saying that he thinks that maybe this is part of the old Great Reset eugenics agenda, because it's going to cause so much trouble. The West has actually inflicted it on itself.
Yeah, well, the deep state World Economic Forum reset is happening as planned, with a takedown of the world economy. But unfortunately, the Chinese and the Russians aren't joining in, and they're in a position to clean up. And of course, that's the problem for the West, is that they've dominated the world for 500 years. But in actual fact, they haven't got the financial or military power to do it anymore. They're going to be cut down to size.
Interesting also, just a little, we're going to talk now about Elon Musk trying to take over Twitter now, because there have been some quite high profile, suspensions and banning from Twitter, which don't really seem to make any sense in terms of even-handed censorship. So, for example, you know, somebody that is saying, you know, if they're part of one party saying one thing is fine, if you don't, anyway, I mean, for example, also DuckDuckGo has been admitting that it's a search engine, but it's admitting, well, we're going to skew our results, you know, pro the Ukrainians and anti-Russian. I'm just looking up New Eastern Outlook on DuckDuckGo. It's not there. I'd just like to recommend, though, a very old search engine. It's from the 1990s, which is what I use nowadays. It's called Lycos.com. And they, you know, stuff just pops up what you're looking for. So when you're doing a search for something political, I'd say into the indefinite future, try it on at several search engines, because you get completely different results. I'm thinking a little bit like that policeman, Martin, who's trying out his system about looking up terrorists' biographies and finding that he's getting different results on different machines. I get completely different results depending on which search engine I use these days. So, yeah, I mean, people, a lot of people have gone to DuckDuckGo from Google because they realise Google is censoring. It's almost like whack-a-mole. You know, as soon as DuckDuckGo, people realise that's no good anymore and you won't find anything useful on there, then they'll go to somewhere else and then that one will be shut down. So it's a bit of a game, this internet search engine business, isn't it?
It is. And of course, the way they finesse it is by saying that these are all private companies. And if they decide, I mean, don't forget that their spiel is that they'll give everybody a fair go. And that's why people use them. But they're also the mask is dropping. They say, well, we're not going to give everybody a fair go. We'll be honest. We're not going to do that. Well, then in case people can draw their own conclusions, in that case, we know which side you're on. And of course, there's a really good article by Katie Johnson on Consortium News about this week, about how they're accusing the Russians of this, that and the other. But Twitter is a state, you know, it's intimate with the Western deep state. The things that they are censoring are the things they want censored, and the things that they are pushing are the things they want pushed. And the way they finesse this, as I say, is that Twitter is supposedly a private company and therefore can say what it likes, just like the Daily Mail or whatever. Now, ultimately, of course, this pushes towards the idea of a nationalised internet with a genuinely open door policy for everybody.
But what do you make of Elon Musk then? Because do you think he's got, he's genuine? He says, I think Twitter is losing its way. It's censoring too much. Therefore, I've got $40 billion here. I want to buy it up.
Well, he just wants it to be censored in a different way, doesn't he? I mean, that's all he's after. I mean, one of his infamous tweets of recent years was when the coup took place in Bolivia, which was ultimately overthrown by popular, you know, revolt and election. He said, we'll coup who we want. Get over it. In other words, he wanted to take the lithium reserves in Bolivia for his private electric car business. And the Bolivians wanted it to be a nationalised industry where the profits would go to the poor people of Bolivia. So you know what side he's on.
You certainly do. Anyway, our final item for part one is a continuation. We've got, I suppose it's a three-part series so far, talking to various people who've had problems with the legal system, and they believe systemic problems that they've observed with the British legal system, getting bad results in court cases, not just from their point of view, but from a perspective subjectively, you know, objectively. Looking at these various people, it seems that the court system has suffered tremendously since 2008 as well, since the bailouts, because there just simply is not enough money for it. A lot of lawyers saying that. And so let's have a listen now to Len Lawrence. He's actually a former pilot based down here in the West Country, and he's a case I find fascinating because he's got together with a whole load of airline pilots from the pilots union, and they are trying to sue the airline manufacturers because there are basic design faults, they say, in these airliners, which means that the cabins have toxic air in them. Now, this doesn't necessarily affect passengers who are just flying one flight, but aircrew are getting in an aircraft day after day after day and breathing this toxic air. In a nutshell, he summed it up to me, and I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. He summed it up to me that the pressurised air that comes into the cabin, of course, all these airliners are pressurised, and so they need to have some quite high pressure air, is taken from the compressor part of one of the jet engines on the aircraft, almost all airliners. And so you have a compressor at the beginning of the jet engine that compresses the air, and then it puts it into the back end of the jet engine where it's set light to. And of course, that makes the plane go forward, right? So that's basically how the jet engine works. Anyway, so the pipe comes from the compressor part of the jet engine, brings some air from the outside world into the cabin. But the problem is that it isn't just pure air, because there are where you get bearings in the engine, some of those bearings leak a tiny little bit of oil, and there are all sorts of additives, nasty additives, in that oil, including organophosphate chemicals, which can then get into that little tube, be put into the cabin. Anyway, this is a phenomenon which has been altered now in the latest 787 Dreamliners. They don't take the air from there anymore, so the airlines have clearly, or sorry, not the airlines, the airliner manufacturers have clearly understood there's something wrong here. But anyway, it's a potentially massive, massive class action. And once the decisions in the courts are made about this, it could mean that many thousands, possibly more, of cabin crew particularly can claim compensation from these airliner manufacturers, that they've been basically poisoned by the stuff in the air in these aircraft. Anyway, so I spoke to Len Lawrence earlier this week, who he found, as he tried to pursue this case, that he was accused of being mentally ill. And there's been a bit of a tussle over whether he's going to succeed in pursuing it into the future, involving the former Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox.
I was referred to a consultant neurologist, Dr. Gorman Jamal. He'd done a lot of work on organophosphate poisoning with the Kurds, who were gassed by, I believe, Saddam Hussein, and also, I think, in the sheep dip poisoning, where all these farmers were poisoned by sheep dip. Anyway, Gorham Jamal said I had a brain injury. I was then referred to the National Hospital for Neurology, Neurosurgery in London, and neuropsychological testing suggested I had an organic problem with to what my presentation. It wasn't psychological, it was organic. The British Airline Pilots Association, Christian Narain, arranged financing for 26 pilots to have blood tests carried out in America. And the results back from Professor Abadonia, Duke's University Department of Neurosciences, showed that we all had chemical-induced nervous system injury, suggesting moderate brain injury. And we all had the same diagnosis. But what was interesting, so I then had my diagnosis, but what was happening, I was still being held by the official solicitor of the High Court, not allowed access to the Court of Protection. The official solicitor is not allowed to make clinical or financial decisions. That's why we have these Court of Protection judges. Now, Professor Turnbull issued a Court of Protection certificate to release me from the official solicitor, and he sent that to the official solicitor's office. A few weeks later, Professor Turnbull spoke with me on the phone, and he said, how are you? I said, I'm still being held. He said, what? I issued a certificate to release you. I said, they've never told me. He said, right, come up to my office tomorrow and I'll issue one on the spot, which he did. And I took that to the Office of the Public Guardian in London. The Office of the Public Guardian had no knowledge of me, never heard of me. So I took it to the official solicitor's office and the handed it in. And that was the last I heard. I now know what had happened. The official solicitor's office, presented with his second Court of Protection certificate, wasn't sure what to do. So they used their own certificate and got that filled in with no reference that I'd been held for 18 months, no reference that I was a Court of Protection. Got that filled in by a psychiatrist, put their own stamp on, not the Court of Protection stamp, then finally released me. And having lived in a house worth around $622,000, in fact, he sold for that, but it was actually valued at 720 and an offer was made at that. I found myself with £80,000 and homeless on the streets, like around 10,000 other veterans.
Crikey. Well, anyway, I mean, this does sound like a bit of a cover-up going on here.
Well,
it's complicated by the situation with the divorce as well. But I mean, what's the most recent developments in this?
Well, what's the most recent development? That bit occurred in 2006. I was very fortunate that I actually got finally when my house had been burned down one night, I was staying, a bit like Mark Purdy, who did the OPs, I was rescued by, believe it, a social worker, and she had me referred to the brain injury specialist rehabilitation. And for over 10 years, I've had specialist neuropsychologists visit me at home, and I'm the support workers to help me. And I've actually come through a lot of this and now understand what's happened to me. But about 4 weeks, no, six, 8 weeks ago, so we're now going back sort of 15 years later, someone has posted to me all of the government legal department's internal emails from the period 2004 to 2006.
Wow. Showing this is, I mean, this is a sort of WikiLeaks.
It's better than that. Not only if it shows how they covered it all up, how they financed it, it shows what they did when I went to Professor Turnbull, how they were angry because I'd gone away from an NHS psychiatrist or a private psychiatrist. Then when Turnbull issued the Court of Protection certificates, they got themselves into a real tizzles what to do.
Why were they so concerned about all this? This is some, you know, what were they saying was the reason why they were, I mean, you know, surely it's up to you who you go to, who you get referred to.
Yeah, but Turnbull, being a military psychiatrist, a wing commander, you know, is a very, he won't be bullied. And he certainly was in this case, and he suspected that something was amiss. It just wasn't right how I was being certified without medicals, how my assets were stripped, yet there was no reference to the Court of Protection. And this is what we've unfolded. Now, there's two videos, actually, I must tell you to look. We do with the poisoning one first. It's called Dark Waters. You can view it on Netflix. Dark Waters. It's all about the cover-up of the Teflon pans, how deadly that Teflon coating is. That is brilliant. That gives you an understanding a bit about aerotoxic, where these events occur and the lengths they go to cover it up. But more importantly, just recently, there's been a DVD release. You can view it on Netflix. It's called I Care A Lot. It stars Rosalind Pike, and it shows guardianship abuse, how all of a sudden people will be placed under the Mental Health Act, their homes will be seized, solicitors and others will go in a revenue-gathering exercise, and these people's lives are destroyed. And that was in what happened in my case. The lawyers were generating £100,000 in legal fees. One Court of Protection hearing I had in front of a judge at Slough, it lasted less than 8 minutes, and I had a £10,000 cost order put on me. But we now know the judge wasn't a Court of Protection judge. He couldn't deal with this.
So, of course, this is what happens, Martin, when you stop funding the courts properly, and also you won't fund legal aid, as Ken Clark, the good old Remainiac, he managed to get rid of legal aid when the Tories and the coalition government first came to power. He also, of course, stopped people squatting to try and find somewhere to live, as we found Len Lawrence was in that awful situation, homeless, just because he was being targeted, basically gang-stalked by the government, it seems, working for who? Well, maybe working for the airline industry, maybe just trying to stop a scandal. But anyway, they can't target people like that. Certainly shouldn't be able to. But anyway, isn't this a kind of result of the shift away, Martin, from funding government properly, and so that private corporations think that now they rule the roost?
Well, I mean, legal aid still exists, but it's a fraction of what it needs to be, which is why the barristers and so on are very angry about it. I think what that story tells me is literally how culpable corporations are. I mean, years ago, the Ralph Nader, the former Green Party presidential candidate and campaigner, he uncovered that the Ford Motor Company had basically designed what were extremely unsafe cars with a petrol tank in the boot, which always exploded whenever these cars had accidents. And they knew that this was a design fault. But they covered it up for years, and it all came out that they made a calculation on how much compensation they'd have to pay to people who crashed the cars and were subsequently injured, burned either fuel, and how much it would cost to recall the cars and redo it. And they made the quite cynical calculation that they would carry on allowing this to go on.
But anyway,
Len, that's standard. Len, that is standard of all corporations.
Len is ex-Royal Navy. He sticks at it. You know, he's a forces man. He's certainly not going to be bullied by these people.
Well, he is being bullied, isn't he?
Well, but he's not going
to... He's being bullied.
He's not going to be... all right, he won't bend over to the bullies. The other aspect of this, Martin, of course, is that this chimes quite similarly with Tim Tate's film. I don't know if you remember, many years ago we interviewed the former World in Action documentary producer who lives down this part of the world these days, Tim Tate. He's also written about child sexual abuse as well. And he explained to us how that he'd got together all this evidence about Boeing's spare parts, which were made not by Boeing, but by basically anybody making something which was supposed to be a Boeing part and then sticking it in an airliner and flying around the world with it. And he had all the evidence for this. And he went to the BBC, he went to Channel 4 with these as a documentary proposal. Channel 4 said, oh no, it's too legally difficult. BBC didn't even bother to get back to him. So this is a major part of all this, is our mass media is actually colluding with people who are making our world a very unsafe place, and also corrupting the courts. But in part two of my chat to Len, which you're going to hear, you can hear the long version, the full version up later tonight on thisweek.org.uk, he explained what happened recently at a Royal Air Force centenary dinner, where he got the impression that perhaps his campaign to get justice for all these people, victims of toxic cabin, which is the air in the cabin being contaminated with organophosphates from the bearings in the engines, those victims may actually get justice as began to transpire at this RAF centenary dinner.
We all sort of had dinner. There was three air chief marshals, an air marshal, some generals, and a whole scattering of other people. But 2 weeks later, I got a phone call asking if a couple of farmers could drop in. They got some apples for me, and I said, yeah, sure. Well, these two guys came, they're in overalls, dungarees, and came in, and we made them some coffee, and they gave me some apples. They stayed for about half an hour, then they left. Then I got a phone call, could they pop back? And they did, but this time they came. They weren't a couple of old farmers. They were from the Security Intelligence Services. And they wanted to view my call to protection certificates. One of them held an equivalent rank for chief constable. But he held this in the military. Anyway, bearing in mind these call to protection certificates had been viewed by the economic major crime unit from Thames Valley, who had been down to see me. They'd been viewed by the organised and serious crime unit of Devon and Cornwall Police. They failed to notice one key thing, that these people, two people from the intelligence services, they looked at them and said, Mr. Lawrence, in 30 seconds, they said, these call to protection certificates are not valid. Not one of them has a court seal on them. They're not valid. And then that's when I went to see the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, when he had the local constituency office in Devon. I went there, and he was brilliant, and he's given me the means to set aside all judgments in my case without the need of a court of appeal, and that has come from the CPS and the Home Office. So I had that. But what I said to Mr. Cox, I said, Mr. Cox, me and my colleagues, predominantly from the military, we will find out how tens of thousands of people are being certified under the Mental Health Act, how the safeguarding policies are not being followed, and who's doing it. And of course, 8 weeks ago, I've got all the evidence. And if you were in a divorce and they wanted to put you down the same route as this, they will get you, because it has to go through the Court of Protection. What the government lawyers are doing would get you to get a friend as a guardian. then they'd tell that guardian to apply for legal aid. They would get you to sign the form, the guardian to sign the form, then the legal aid board would grant legal aid, and as soon as that legal aid's granted, the solicitor who organised it will suddenly say, you're not a suitable person, nor is your guardian, and instruct it to the court, to the official solicitor. They will step in. Then they've got all the financing they want from the legal aid agency to do what they think. They get a charge over your house, so they know they can actually run up horrendous fees, knowing that the legal agency and them will get paid.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty horrific story. Sounds to me like some widespread corruption in the judicial system, whereby people who are trying to, or on the opposite side to the powerful from them in the courts, can just simply have charges against their property, basically be made homeless as part of a way to destabilise and abuse the court process, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I listened with interest to all of that, but obviously, there's a lot more to it than we've just heard.
Yeah, so if people are interested, they can listen to the whole story. It's probably about 45 minutes, maybe even an hour long, on thisweek.org.uk later. But I mean, we've had over the last few weeks, we had Dr. Mark Jones on, Steve Smythe, and from Liverpool. And it just seems as if this is this is something I'd love to do on this program, is just to, so people can just tell their stories. These are horrific cases where someone is going, expecting to get some sort of justice and finding that the whole court process, has been somehow usurped. They're getting a judge that is crooked, corrupt. He's making judgments which are invalid. And, it's just lucky that he's managed to go to Sir Geoffrey Cox there, to the Attorney General himself, to get these things overturned, to get justice for an ex-serviceman. Absolutely amazing and unbelievable. And of course, the fact of the matter is now, Sir Geoffrey Cox got booted out by Boris Johnson in the 2020 reshuffle, Martin.
Yes, very interesting. And of course, this is a more significant case than the others that you mentioned, because of course it's the airline manufacturers who are ultimately being protected here, and they're the ones. And you know, as I said before, the Teflon coating on pans. There's all sorts of evidence to suggest that it's toxic.
Okay,
it's been protected.
So just to remind listeners and ourselves about those documentaries that will be just being recommended there by Len Lawrence. It's first of all, it's one called I Care a Lot, which is about the abuse of this process of guardianship. The idea being that you can basically say that you are a guardian and of a specific individual or whatever, and then find that you're losing everything as a result of it. And also the other one is called I Care a Lot, and the other documentary is called Dark Waters, and it's all about the poisonous Teflon. So of course, if you go into a Martin, this is what amazes me about this stuff. If you go into a cookery shop or a supermarket or wherever it is you want to go and buy a new pan, what will you get? You will get a whole load of Teflon coated pans. I mean, this is just terrible. It's crazy. It's disgusting. It's madness. And it's actually quite difficult to get a stainless steel non-Teflon pan. I tried to do it recently. I had to get a second-hand one on eBay, which is just a horrible thing to have to do. Why on earth can't we just have stuff that works? We've been talking over the last 6 months or so about the dangers of aluminium, and yet you've got to have basically a toxic thing to cook your stuff in. Anyway, that's it for part one. We'll be back in a little while to talk about Ukraine, and particularly about the sinking of the Moscow, and see if you can figure out what's going on here with our second song from 1967, which is Andy Williams, because it relates to a story over the last few weeks that we've seen, that signs have been going up on London tube trains telling people not to stare at ladies.
The book Ecclesiasticus, chapter 2. My child, when you come to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for testing. Set your heart right and be steadfast. and do not be impetuous in time of calamity. Cling to him, and do not depart, so that your last days may be prosperous. Accept whatever befalls you, and in times of humiliation, be patient. For gold is tested in the fire, and those found acceptable in the furnace of humiliation. Trust in him, and he will help you. Make your way straight, and hope in him. You who fear the Lord, wait for his mercy. Do not stray, or else you may fall. You who fear the Lord, trust in him, and your reward will not be lost. You who fear the Lord, hope for good things, for lasting joy and mercy. Consider the generations of old and see, has anyone trusted in the Lord and been disappointed? Or has anyone persevered in the fear of the Lord and been forsaken? Or has anyone called upon him and been neglected? For the Lord is compassionate and merciful. He forgives sins and saves in time of distress. Woe to timid hearts and to slack hands, and to the sinner who walks a double path. Woe to the faint-hearted who have no trust, therefore they will have no shelter. Woe to you who have lost your nerve. What will you do when the Lord's reckoning comes? Those who fear the Lord do not disobey his words, and those who love him keep his ways. Those who fear the Lord seek to please him, and those who love him are filled with his law. Those who fear the Lord prepare their hearts and humble themselves before him. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, but not into the hands of mortals. For equal to his majesty is his mercy, and equal to his name are his works. Here ends the first lesson.
My Lord, were you there? could be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you. Pardon the way that I stay. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak. There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
From 1967, that is Andy Williams there with the great the lyrics are, pardon the way that I stare, there's no one else to compare. Well, I mean, he's doing something that you're not allowed to do anymore. And before that, we heard Were You There from the Treorchy, the great, the one and only Treorchy Male Voice Choir. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. That is where we bypass the psycho in the corner week after week here with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Big event of the week, though, Martin, is glug, 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 isn't it?
Well, I presume by that you're referring to what's happened to the Russian ship in the Black Sea.
Yes, it's a cruiser called the Moscow. It's the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet, but it is no more.
Well, there are various reports about whether it's really completely kaput or whether it's potentially, you know, can be salvaged. But of course, the other big news, which of course this is the news that the West wants us to hear, the other big news is the mass surrenders of Ukrainian regular forces in Mariupol. Thousands of them have thrown in the towel.
Okay, so let's
which
go.
Of course, which what should be the news?
Well, exactly. But South Front make that exact point, because we're going to hear now from South Front. They are one of those analysts, military analyst sites, a bit like the Saker, actually, that we never hear anything about in any of the London media. But they actually do a much, much better job than any of our Western press and the army reservists in the London press, in producers, editors, etc., whoever they are, whatever they're up to, they're certainly not getting out facts like this. So let's have a listen now to, and it'd be great to hear your take on this, Martin, because they do exactly what you just did, is they compare the timing of the sinking of the ship to the mass surrender in Mariupol.
On the night of April 13th to 14th, the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, the cruiser Moscow, was seriously damaged or sank. A ship of this class in the Black Sea conditions could have been successfully attacked either by a complex of anti-ship systems, including both missiles and aircraft, or by a submarine. There's a strong possibility that NATO military was directly involved in the attack. This also became a suitable diversion from the events taking place in Mariupol. On the 12th and 13th of April, over 1,300 Ukrainian soldiers and officers voluntarily surrendered to Russian captivity, or were forced to do so under the threat of extermination. This is an unprecedented number of soldiers and officers of warring armies that have surrendered since World War II. However, Kiev claimed that a significant number of soldiers from the 36th Brigade was able to merge with the Azovstal garrison, reinforcing it. The area of the Azovstal plant itself is a heavily fortified stronghold with extensive multi-level underground communications. The degree of fortification of Azovstal is far superior to that of the Nazi fortress of Konigsberg during World War II. Fighters of the Azov battalion try to take refuge in the basements of residential buildings with the aim of later exiting the city in the guise of civilians. According to conservative estimates, there were at least 14,000 of the most combat-ready and qualified servicemen of Kiev's forces on the territory of Mariupol before it was encircled. As of April 13th, the remaining forces were estimated at between 4,000 and 6,000 combat-ready Ukrainian servicemen. More Ukrainian armed forces units and foreign mercenaries have arrived in Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkov regions to take part in the upcoming battle for these regions in the east. The Russian military took advantage of the momentum and struck at the concentration of Kiev's troops. For example, Russian artillery struck six strongholds of the units of the 24th Independent Mechanized Brigade near the village of Popasna. Over 120 servicemen of the unit, 11 armored vehicles, and 14 vehicles of various purposes were destroyed. There are reports from Kharkov that three new nationalist battalions of the Ukrainian armed forces are being formed in the city. These battalions are supposed to blockade Kharkov from the south and by no means allow the local population to leave the city. In the Izium sector, Russian units are advancing towards Slovyansk and Kramatorsk from the north. Meanwhile, a large number of military equipment and servicemen have been concentrated in Russia's Belgorod region. These units are likely meant to take part in the upcoming battle for the east of Ukraine. In the evening of April 13th, the Russian Defense Ministry said that it had recorded attempts at sabotage and strikes by Ukrainian forces against facilities on Russian territory. It said that if such incidents continue, Russia will strike at Ukrainian decision-making centers, including those in Kiev, which the Russian military has so far refrained from doing. This statement raises a number of questions. For example, has the military and political leadership of Russia not yet realized that it is in a full-scale war, at least with the pro-NATO Kiev regime in Ukraine, and probably with NATO, albeit indirectly? Why, until recently, was there no military unity of command in the military operation of the Russian Defense Ministry in Ukraine, as British intelligence, eyewitnesses, and events on the front lines declare and demonstrate? The supply of weapons to Kiev from NATO countries, including tanks, is intensifying. The direct participation of NATO units in the conflict is on the agenda. According to local sources on both sides of the conflict, up to 40% of the most combat-ready Ukrainian units are already composed of citizens of NATO member states. The incident with the Russian cruiser Moscow could be the trigger for a sharp escalation of the conflict, which is in the interests of a large part of the so-called global elites. The difficult domestic political situation in the United States, Germany, and France is fueling the desire of the ruling elites to retain power by launching, and under the excuse of, World War III.
Well, so they don't hedge their bets, do they, Martin, at all at South Front? And I think that's a pretty good analysis. So looking at all of the areas, many of which are very difficult to get into, not least of which is that the, you know, basic facts about the number of NATO country citizens who are actual combatants in the Ukrainian army, supposedly.
Well, that's right. I mean, the fact is, that's an analysis based on somebody's looking at the stats and you know, doing what you and I probably do, which is trying to get as much information
very as balanced,
possible.
Though, I think. Very balanced. I mean, you know, well, he's saying, yeah, for example, let me finish. Yeah, so he's saying, for example, that the people who surrendered in Mariupol may have been threatened with extermination before they, and so they had to surrender, maybe. You know, so we don't know, do we? But he's trying to give both sides.
Well, I mean, it's a relatively balanced account compared to what you get in the Western media, for sure. I mean, basically, the Western media have ignored the obvious point. What is the Ukrainian army, the bulk of it, doing in the Donbass? If they were defending Ukraine, they should have been around Kiev, shouldn't they? But they weren't. And this is why the war took place, is because over 18 months, NATO, because NATO is in fact in charge. Did you see there's a French journalist from Le Figaro who tried to be a volunteer, and he found he was dealing with an American officer. And that looks like that NATO is actually micromanaging the Ukrainian battle. So they're already in there. Obviously, one of the things that was suggested about the sinking of the ship was that the anti-ship missiles, which Boris Johnson promised the Ukrainians, had already been delivered, and that maybe British personnel were responsible for sinking the ship. Now, of course, that I don't necessarily, there's all sorts of rumours float around in wars. Who knows? But of course, if the British did sink the ship, then the obvious answer for the Russians is to sink a British ship in Plymouth Harbour and see how you like that. And of course, that's where we're going with this if we're not careful.
Well, I think we aren't careful. It seems to me quite obvious.
No, I think the policy of the West has been very reckless.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's
deliberately.
The Russians are trying hard to keep it within, you know, agreed limits.
Isn't it deliberately,
but ultimately,
deliberately
if
reckless?
If you don't want those limits, then there will be no limits.
Isn't it deliberately reckless? I mean, what he's saying there, for example, it could have been, I think the official version from Ukraine is that it was a cruise missile. Now,
no, it's not official, it's unofficial,
unofficial,
as I understand it.
Okay, so it could,
yeah, so
could,
in
but it could
fact,
also have been an aircraft.
What officially is saying is that they don't know what happened, and it looks like it just might be a fire. Now, things do, you know, the Russians are not saying that they were hit by a missile. In actual fact, it's definitely not a submarine, because the fire was on the decks. It wasn't a torpedo hit. So it might have been a missile.
It could have been fired from a submarine. You get these cruise missiles now can pop out of a submarine and fly.
Well,
along.
I mean, the fact is they've got Neptune missiles, I understand, but they've only got a couple of them. But of course, Boris Johnson has been promising them sea strike missiles. So, you know, if it wasn't the British who shot it this time, next time it happens, it probably would be. Although they've got a problem, because all this stuff that they're promising to the Ukrainians, we're going to send you tanks, this, that, and the other, is how are they going to get it to the front line when the Russians have got air superiority? They'll just try and whack it as soon as it crosses the border.
Well, what about
and the Russians made that clear? Well, they may decide that we're not going to wait till it crosses the border. Yeah, we're on that cusp.
Yeah, I mean, you know, also potentially NATO being in charge of the sinking of this Russian flagship of the Black Sea. This is the sort of thing that NATO have been actually drooling over doing something like this for decades, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, in actual fact, it's a somewhat outdated capital ship. But of course, it's a political embarrassment for the Russians. If it was just a fire, it's an embarrassment. And of course, if it was taken down by a Ukrainian missile, that's even worse in one way. But on the other hand, it's not actually any, you know, in terms of the actual fighting on the ground, that is a ship that should, in fact, be in the Eastern Mediterranean facing off with NATO fleets. It's actually wasted in the Black Sea. And of course, the other significant development, which people haven't picked up on, is that the West wants to send naval forces into the Black Sea, and the Turks have told them, no, you can't, because they're sitting on the fence. They're part of NATO, but they're not putting sanctions on Russia.
Yeah, interesting. Fascinating. The Russians themselves, difficult to figure out what they're saying about all this.
Well, they're saying we don't fight. We don't know what's happened here. We're still looking into it. we'll let you know.
Well, yes, but that's also they were trying to play it down, weren't they, originally, the Russians?
Yes.
So the significance of, there's so much in that report from South Front. I think they've done a fantastic job there. This Azovstal fortress in Mariupol, what do we know about that? That seems to be the centre of the resistance. But Azovstal sounds to me like it's the Azov battalion. Is that, might they be involved in it?
It's Azov as in the Sea of Azov.
Right, yeah.
Which is, of course, the name of the plant is Azovstal, and the Azov Battalion is because of the Sea of Azov.
I mean, there are some rumours.
That's why it's all called Azov.
There are some rumours of Western commanders actually in there, commanders, rather than this just
being
Ukrainian
army. Obviously, I'm trying to follow all this from various sources, and what pro-Russian sources are saying, that there have been several attempts by helicopters to get into Mariupol and take out the senior NATO people who are in there, but they've all been shot down. And of course, the Azov battalion are now holed up inside this steel plant. And in many ways, that's probably the best place for them, because they were, as far as I can see, preventing the civilian population from leaving and massacring people, you know, basically shooting them. I mean, the way the Russians have been fighting in Syria is that you surround ISIS or whatever it is that's controlling an area, and you give them a chance either to surrender, or you may negotiate that you can go. That's why Idlib province has become the repository for all of the militants that have come from all over the world to fight in Syria. Because the Russian policy is, instead of storming in and killing them, we give them, we say, you can take your weapons, but you've got to go over here. And they're going to do exactly the same, I imagine, in the Donbass. They do not want to kill as maximum number of people. If people are prepared to surrender, I don't think they're going to be prepared to let people take their weapons and go back to the West Ukraine. But if they say that they're prepared to leave with no weapons, I think they'll say, right, okay, you can go then. That's, I presume, the policy. But of course, the Azov battalion, which has been funded by Kolomoisky, who's Zelensky's paymaster, they are integrated into the Ukrainian armed forces, but they are basically a right-wing paramilitary who've got many, you know, there's no balance in the Western report.
Okay, let's just look at another thing that South Front was saying there. They're talking about Kharkiv, or Kharkov, as it's known in the West generally, which is in the northeast of the country, northeast or sort of east of Kyiv, where there was a lot of fighting in World War II, particularly around that city, and I think historically, actually. But he's saying that there's a whole load of new battalions been formed south of Kharkiv, and that one of their most important roles, which just sends shivers down my spine, is to make sure that civilians can't leave the city.
Yeah, well, if you remember, a few weeks ago, we were being told what a brilliant idea it was for Zelensky. He's just handing out weapons to anybody. And therefore, you know, you can form a dad's army and they will give you the guns. The problem with that is, are these people legitimate combatants or not? And the answer is, in international law, they're not. And therefore, they've got no rights under the Geneva Convention and so on. And this is also going to be an issue for the British guy who's been captured in Mariupol, because he's basically, you know, he shouldn't be there under international law.
Oh, you're talking about
Geneva Convention protection.
You're talking about Aidan Aslin.
Yeah.
Apparently, he's surrendered to Russian forces along with Ukrainian forces in that big surrender earlier in the week. He said when he joined the Ukrainian military in 2018, he thought he was on the good side. But, I mean, this is a typical story that you'd expect a propaganda story to be rolled out, isn't it? He said the situation in Mariupol was an eye-opener for him, claiming he sought to convince his commanders to leave the city, but they chose to stay because Kyiv supposedly wanted them to stay.
Well, I mean, he's now in Russian custody, and his family have said, please, please treat him nicely. And so it's very much in his interest to say these kind of things. I think this is going to be a problem going forward as the Russians take more and more prisoners. But I think the Russian policy is to take prisoners, very definitely, rather than fight it out. Because even in the pocket, the Donbass pockets, because there's more than one pocket now, I think, you've still got quite a lot of civilians. And the policy has always been to basically put their tanks and artillery and everything, they've got lots of bunkers because they've had years to develop them, in populated areas. And that makes it very difficult. And the same with ISIS in Syria. And it makes it very difficult for the contending forces.
I mean, whatever you think of, the rights and wrongs of what Aidan Aslin is saying. That's Alden. It's Alden, Aslin. Whatever he's saying with his black skull on his T-shirt, the Zelensky-style khaki T-shirt, is that the thing that disgusted him most was the lack of care for civilians. Now, you're saying that you think maybe he's just saying this to butter up the Russians.
Well, that's what the West will say. That's all I'll say about that. But I think the evidence suggests that, especially in the East Ukraine, where the people voted to leave the Ukraine, Mariupol and all these other places voted to leave by quite big margins, voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014. And this, of course, is the ultimate political justification for the Russian special military operation, is that they've been saying for years, you've got to negotiate with the rebels. And that's what the Minsk agreements say, which you've signed up for and the Germans and the French have agreed to. And the Steinmeier, the president of Germany, the Steinmeier principles were that the Ukrainians would withdraw from the Donbass and from Luhansk. There would then be a discussion about a referendum, another referendum, and that's the way the thing should be resolved. But as things stand, the bulk of the Ukrainian army, most of whom are not from the Donbass, but are actually from Western Ukraine, and soldiers like the British guy who've got no dog in the fight, really, they're all in there. But they're occupying land where people voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014. And that's what the Russians are enforcing now, just as NATO enforced Kosovan rule to secede from Serbia with a 78-day bombing campaign, which was largely directed at civilian infrastructure. But the Russians aren't smashing the infrastructure in the Ukraine. They've taken much more military casualties than what they would normally be expected to do, because they're trying to preserve the lives of the civilian population. And Pentagon sources anonymously have confirmed that. So all of this kind of stuff, I mean, the Bucha massacre, which we talked about last week,
Bucha.
It's becoming increasingly clear that that was carried out by these irregulars who have been armed by Zelensky. They went into the place as soon as the Russians left and rounded up the people they didn't mind and shot them.
If you look at last week's show, we didn't actually reference it directly on the programme, but I put a link to, I think it was on Mint Press News, I can't remember where now, but I thought an excellent article which was charting the Telegram channel of one of these Nazis, from one of the Nazi groups in Ukraine, who were the first group to go into Bucha after the Russians went out, and he was actually boasting about, right, we're going to be killing civilians. Is it okay to kill civilians? Yes, of course it is.
Yeah, which is why, of course, all of the Western politicians, including Boris Johnson, immediately piped up, this is a war crime. Anybody who's done this will have to stand trial. Blah, blah, blah. Putin will have to stand trial. Well, if it's your side that's doing it, Boris, maybe you've got to go to The Hague. You've got to stand trial. And, of course, this is where this atrocity propaganda can be turned back on the West.
Isn't it funny?
They've worked everybody up about it.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, it turns out that the Ukrainian army are the main culprits. And, of course, they are, going back to 2014. They've killed far more civilians than the Russians have.
In a way, I mean,
the people in the West faced up.
Well, I think you're right. Yes, but I mean, you can look at a clear pattern emerging here, a psychological warfare pattern, very much like the previous story we were doing in part one about election fixing. The idea is that the tactics that the Western oligarchy want to use, that NATO are using, against their various so-called enemies, you know, in search of enemies, as they've found these enemies now, which are not necessarily credible, like this whole thing about, oh, well, the Russians are fixing our elections, the Russians are hacking Brexit, you know, these are the things that which the West is doing. And what they're doing is they're getting these things out there, things like chemical weapons attacks in Ukraine, things like that. They're saying, and in Syria, of course, they are putting out stories about the things that they themselves are doing and intend to do in the future, so that when these things do occur, whether it's a chemical attack or whatever, that people will automatically, in their own minds, assume that it's the Russians that are behind it.
That is true, and I think it was a Newsweek article, which I have circulated, where they had people saying, well, actually, we're doing a good job here in the psychological warfare section of the Western Alliance, because what we're doing is by seeding these various information war bombs into the situation, we're winning the war against Putin's evil regime. And of course, they specifically mentioned the chemical weapons. And they said, well, in actual fact, we've got no evidence that they use chemical weapons. But the reason why we said all of that is so that we can deter the Russians from using chemical weapons. And they even patted themselves on the back about doing this. Now, people need to work, get on top of this. The Western intelligence services are boasting that they are lying successfully. And that is where they're at. And in actual fact, you can't take anything they say at face value, anything at all. The Russians, on the other hand, Russian Ministry of Defense, is saying very little, but trying to make sure that everything they do say is checkable.
Yeah, and also, strategies. There's some very conciliatory stuff coming out of Russia. It's not so much threatening, but they are saying, look, there may be unpredictable consequences if Washington keeps arming Ukraine. Washington Post reported that. We call on the United States and its allies to stop the irresponsible militarization of Ukraine, which implies unpredictable consequences for regional and international security. The Post quoted Russia saying in a diplomatic note to the US. The report comes 2 days after Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said Russia will view US and NATO vehicles transporting weapons on Ukrainian territory as legitimate military targets. The RT channel is pretty, even though parts, it's not so, you obviously can't get the TV, you can get it on the internet. It's quite tight-lipped about what happened to the Moscow. But the point here, Martin, is that I interviewed Scott Ritter when this all first started, and he was quite adamant. Look, they're not going to get weapons in there because the Russians will spot them from satellites, from drones, and blow them up anyway. But I mean, it seems that that NATO is actually being quite good at getting its weapons into to aid, and that's why Russia is now saying, "Look, you've got to stop this militarization of Ukraine because there'll be unpredictable consequences." Well, maybe the NATO countries, the Western oligarchy, the Anglo-Zionist Empire, maybe they want war.
Well, they do. Even Zelensky said it. Some people in the West just want this to drag on as a means of making the Russian, tying the Russians down. And they're even openly talking about, yes, we want a guerrilla war. Now, that's not much use to the regular Ukrainian army who's about to be smashed. When you were all smashed, if some of you can escape, you can be guerrillas and fight on over the next 20 years.
I mean, how much does Zelensky actually care for Ukraine? Because he seems to be in the process of making sure it gets completely mangled.
Well, he's basically a puppet of other forces. He was elected with quite a substantial majority because he wasn't Poroshenko. Poroshenko was demanding war with Russia to take back the Donbass and Crimea. Now, in actual fact, majority of people in the rest of the Ukraine are sick of the war. They didn't want that. That's why they voted for Zelensky, and Kolomoisky obviously had groomed Zelensky. And Zelensky's pitch to the electorate was, I am going to make peace with the Russians. Then, when he tried to make peace with the Russians, he went to the East Ukraine, and the Paribi and the other fascists said, you're not making peace with the Russians. If you try, we will kill you. Now, at that point, Zelensky goes back to his handlers in the West and said, I want to make peace with the Russians, but the far right in the military, because they've taken over the military, that's what they've done. The Paribi was made, like a commissar of the general in charge of the Ukrainian army. Can you tell them to stop so I can make peace? And that the Germans and the French, for example, would probably have gone along with that. Not the British and the Americans, of course. You see, Ben Wallace, when he was pranked, going on about, we don't want the French and the Germans involved in this now. It's got to be the British and the Americans and the Ukrainians on their own. And they said, no, we want a war. Now, Zelensky, of course, also is a suspicion that he isn't even in Kiev, that he's already in Poland. But in any case, he will be spirited out. And he's got millions. We know from the Panama Papers, he's made millions out of being the president. And he's already got massive real estate in Florida, where he can be, round the corner from Donald Trump.
Kolomoisky is his backer. These oligarchs, it's really important, I think, for people to understand who they are, what they are. This is a bunch of people who were basically trained in Switzerland. back in the 1980s to rape Russia's resources. All of its state-owned industries were basically privatised for peanuts to these people, who then made an absolute fortune out of it. But the West, it seems to be in two minds about, maybe it's Kolomoisky that they like, Abramovich they don't like.
Yeah, well, it's quite simple, because Kolomoisky's on their side and Abramovich ain't. It's the Ukrainian oligarchs who have been, you know, did you see, I don't know if people have noticed this, but Medvedchuk, who's an opposition politician to Zelensky, has been arrested, and he's saying, I will exchange him for Ukrainian POWs. Now, he's the leader of the opposition in what's left of Ukraine. He's been arrested. Yeah? I mean, there's so much, the Western presentation in the mainstream media of what's going on is incredibly partial.
Okay, so do you want to just give us a guide as to where we can look to get some decent info?
Well, I mean, I'm getting my information at the moment from Vineyard of the Saker, Moon of Alabama, and Reminiscences of the Future. There's lots of cross-posting by people who use those sites. I mean, another thing that ought to have made big news in the West, and I wish I'd mentioned it to our Liberal Democrat colleague the other week, is that one of the negotiators between Ukraine and Russia came back from one of these meetings and was shot dead by the Ukrainian secret police without a trial, without anything. It just said he's a traitor, shot dead on camera outside a courtroom. You'd have thought that might have made the BBC headlines, but apparently not.
Well, maybe, but he just said the wrong thing in the room.
Well, yes. And the other thing that people have got to take on board, two important facts. Why is the Ukrainian army in the East Ukraine? Yeah? If they just wanted to hold the front line, they don't need to have 60,000 troops there. And in actual fact, if they were defending the Ukraine, they should have been around Kiev. So the reason they're there is because they were going to attack the Donbass, what's left of it. That's what they were going to do. And the Russian military knew they were going to do that, which is why they decided to attack rather than wait to be attacked. That was a military decision.
Now, the big thing for Easter is, where is this now heading? It's obviously the sinking of the Moscow cruiser, even though it's a Soviet-era ship, it's still their flagship for the Black Sea Fleet, is going to dominate the headlines. It's quite clear that this is a major victory for Ukraine, but potentially it may be a strike against US ships, for example, in the Black Sea. And I noticed that the US has been moving some of its ships into the Black Sea. What do you make of that as a possibility that maybe they're going into the Baltic. There's more NATO warships all arriving in the Baltic. They're not allowed, as you said, into the Black Sea, so they're turning up around Sweden and Finland, who just coincidentally are now making a lot of noise about wanting to join NATO. Now, I'm not sure if they've asked their citizens about that, and the Russians are now saying, well, if you do that, then we'll have to move our nukes right up near the border.
Yeah, can I just make the further point I wanted to make, which is the negotiations in Ukraine and Russia only began when this war began. And I feel like saying to Boris Johnson, what should the Ukrainian negotiating position be? And he said, he waffles, he goes, waffle, 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 waffle. And why has it taken a war to get them to negotiate? The British and the Americans have been saying to Zelensky all along not to negotiate. Now, people need to focus on this negotiation thing, because that's the only way to end this. It's been the only way from the get-go. And we've been discouraging negotiations.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that NATO and the West don't want to end it. They're actually pouring weapons in.
They want to fight to the last Ukrainian.
Like the great god of the film Zardoz, pouring weapons into the conflict. That seems to me that they want it to carry on as long as possible.
That's true. But the problem, as Scott Ritter pointed out, a lot of this weaponry isn't going to get there. And much of it is junk, frankly. And what's actually happening is politicians in the West are riding the bandwagon of wanting to be seen to be doing something, and let's send some more weapons. Now, the question of whether you should send weapons in the first place, and the second question is, why do you think that's going to change the military balance? Because it isn't. It just isn't. Now, what's beginning to shape up is an ongoing, if let's just say, hopefully, that the Ukrainian crisis can be resolved over the summer. So that eventually the Russians capture the bits of the Ukraine that they want. There's a ceasefire, and then everybody, you know, hunkers down, as they've been doing in Bosnia since the 1990s. That's the best result. But, of course, the ongoing effect of that will be the militarization of Europe and, of course, the wrecking of the European economy. And the wrecking of the European economy is such an important part of the world economy. We're going to have another version of 2008. That's what's going to happen.
Martin, can you just address this thing for the Baltic? Because Black Sea is at the southern flank of Russia and Georgia and the Caucasus. The Baltic is the northwestern flank, isn't it? And there's NATO vessels carrying out exercises now in the chugging into the Baltic.
Well, I'm glad that you've explained the difference between the Baltic and the Black Sea, because Liz Truss didn't seem to understand it, did she, the other week? Rather important. The Russians have got a problem because they haven't got any access to the sea in the Mediterranean and in the North Sea. They've got, obviously, access to the Pacific, Vladivostok. So for them, this is quite problematic. But don't forget, what's actually happening in the war zone in the south is that they're capturing the Black Sea littoral. And I don't think they intend to give that back.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the rump Ukrainian state, which will come out of this, will have no access to the sea. Transdniestria, which is Russian-controlled because of a conflict...
I don't know what you're saying, because the Ukrainians have said that this Moscow ship was sunk from cruise missiles fired from along that coast. So clearly the Ukrainian army are quite happily in control of that coast. They're not giving it up, are they?
No, they're not in control of it yet. But I think that the end game is going to be when they've taken the Donbass, they're going to take control of the Black Sea littoral because it links up with Transdniestria, which is just on the Dniester River, which has been under Russian control because they broke away from Moldova in the 1990s, where Lebed went and sorted it out and brought in Russian peacekeepers. So, and historically, Odessa and all these other regions are Russian-speaking. Okay, so there's going to be a partition of Ukraine. And, of course, the Russians may just decide to stick to Donbass and Luhansk. I think they probably won't, because it doesn't make military sense for them to just do that. And therefore, ultimately, there'll have to be some kind of ceasefire, possibly not even a peace treaty, because the Ukrainians probably say, we're never going to accept that, but we want a ceasefire. Now, that's probably the best outcome. We need a ceasefire is the best outcome here, and some negotiations. But the West isn't encouraging negotiations. They're encouraging the more extreme elements in the Ukraine to fight on and fight on. And I feel like saying that maybe Boris Johnson would be better employed inside the Mariupol pocket. And then he can show off his Churchillian bulldog spirit.
Yeah, but look,
under Russian bombardment.
But look, in reality, with this Russian ship being sunk, if the Russians... and of course they do. They have lots of these sort of electronic listening devices, satellites, etc. Discover that actually it was a NATO unit that killed that ship, that sunk it. Then could we just see? Do you think some sort of attack on a NATO country or a NATO ship suddenly going to the bottom of the Black Sea?
Let's not jump the gun here. I mean, the Russians are saying that it's a fire, but and they're trying to work out how it happened. Even if they conclude that it was either the Ukrainians or NATO that did it, they wouldn't necessarily say anything about it. But of course, it then put the calculator. It's quite possible that a British team with sea strikes are in Odessa. And if that is the case, and I think there are some Russian sailors who have been killed in this or have been injured, then I wouldn't want to be on a Royal Navy ship anywhere in the world, because the Russians will pick their moment and then they'll do it back, won't they?
Also, Martin, I mean, we've talked a lot about the European front, but, you know, we can't really forget about the Middle East. That's been chugging along, hasn't it, for many years now. And today we've seen the Israelis attack the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Iranians are saying this shows the desperation of the Zionists. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Abir Abdullahian has announced the Israeli regime's attack at Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying resistance is alive while the Zionists are in desperation. Today, resistance is its best situation while the Zionist terrorist regime is at its weakest position. The brazen attack was a result of the betrayal by certain Arab and Muslim countries of the Palestinian cause through normalizing ties with Israel. More than 150 Palestinian worshippers were injured earlier today when Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied old city of Al-Quds. The Palestinian news agency Ma'an said the violence broke out at dawn on Friday when the occupation forces raided the mosque through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Maghrabi Gate, randomly firing sound bombs and rubber bullets at the worshippers. Media reports said the Israeli troops attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards and beat a number of them. The top Iranian diplomat reiterated the Islamic Republic's support for an independent Palestine with east of Jerusalem as its capital, although he calls it Al-Quds, as they do. He said he would continue diplomatic consultations from Muslim countries to bring an end to the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. So it's not very nice, is it, going charging into the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Good Friday, Martin?
No, and of course the war in the Ukraine is part of a global conflict. The Russian army have been fighting in Syria against Israeli-backed and Western-backed Salafi terrorists for years now. And of course, that's not that far away from the Ukraine. And the possibility is that that the Idlib province is in northern Syria. Both the Syrians and the Russians said that we're going to take that back. And they've got a substantial the Russian fleet isn't in the Baltic and it isn't in the Black Sea. It's in the Mediterranean, and it's there so that when they take back the Idlib pocket, the Turks can't intervene because they're going to be whacked by the Russian fleet.
Well, so back in Jerusalem, the Israeli authorities are saying that worshippers threw stones and set off fireworks during morning prayer. That's why they had to go charging in. And as a result, 50,000 Palestinians have come to that part of Jerusalem and are apparently came to do Friday prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So, you know, this is, again, Martin, this is a kind of a provocation, really, is it, send the army in. They say it was fireworks. Maybe they thought it was some sort of terrorist. But the last thing you want to do is send the army, the Israeli army, into Al-Aqsa Mosque, surely.
Well, that's what set off the first intifada. Exactly. Now, people talk about the Wailing Wall, yeah, which is at the bottom of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and many Jews believe that it's the remnants of the Jewish temple. Other archaeologists believe that it's actually the remnants of Hadrian's Roman temple. But let's just leave that aside. The point is that Israel was given a territory in 1948, and it didn't include any of Jerusalem at all. None whatsoever. So everything they've taken since then has been taken by force. Yeah. And we're now reaching a situation where we can compare what happens in Sri Lanka and Kashmir and Israel and Ukraine and see who is taking land by force.
The Red Crescent.
Now, if nobody's allowed to take land by force, nobody's allowed to take
the Red. The Red Crescent reported at least 152 Palestinians who were injured by rubber bullets and tear gas, 8 of whom are in intensive care. 3 police officers were lightly injured.
Yeah, well, I mean, the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque unite the Muslim world and also the Palestinian national movement, as we saw, a couple of years ago when there was, you know, all sorts of conflict going on inside Israel proper between Arab-speaking Palestinian Israeli citizens and the state. And also linking up with what was going on in Gaza and the West Bank.
Okay, trying to be clear here, it's the police, armed police, that go in there with the riot gear, etc. But, I mean, it surely would have been better if the Israeli police had just simply not turned up. There wouldn't have been any problem.
Well, indeed. And it would probably be better if the Israelis would abide by international law and withdraw from territories which they have seized by force since 1948. And of course, the Russians' diplomatic service ripped into the Israelis last week. I sent you the link about that, saying, you know, you're not in any position to criticise what we're doing in Ukraine after what you've been doing for years and years and years. And if you think about it, the wars in Lebanon and Iraq and so on are also responsibility of the Israelis. They have killed millions of people directly and indirectly, but it's the Russians who are the world's pariah. Now, if you can put sanctions on Russia just like that, then you can put sanctions on Israel just like that, can't you? The scales are falling from the world's eyes.
Okay, so
about Western policy.
Not necessarily, I'm afraid. I think the scales are compounding themselves, building up further and further on the eyes of many. What about the Finns and the Swedes? Are they going to join NATO in some sort of a rush job over the next couple of months?
Well, it looks as if it's in the cards, because the political elites in both Finland and Sweden seem to have decided that's what they want to do. And opinion polls show, because they're exposed to the same kind of propaganda we are, that a majority seem to think they want this. I'm particularly annoyed about Finland, because Finland, don't forget, fought on the wrong side in World War II. They were involved in the siege of Leningrad, where Putin's from. And the Finnish army were besieging Leningrad.
But that's after, hang on, Martin, that could be fair. It's after the Soviets invaded them.
Well, they had a reason for doing it. But then also what happened at the end of the war is precisely because they ended up at the wrong side at the end of the war, they decided they were going to be neutral. And that was a conscious policy decision by the Finns that they needed to be on the good side of the Soviets because they'd blotted their copybook. And although they're very suspicious, you know, the Finns have got good reason to be very suspicious of the Russians. The Russians, you know, they broke out of the Russian Empire in 1905. They were attacked by the Soviets. There was a civil war between the left wing and the right wing in Finland, which was extremely bloody, but the right wing won. So they've got a lot of reasons to be have their feelings about the Russians. But because they live next door to them, they've also been absolutely adamant in the past that they are not going to join anti-Russian alliances. And that's, you know, in many ways, that policy has served them very, very well. The Russians have always treated them with the utmost respect. And, you know, in many ways, they were the, you know, when people wanted to talk to the Russians behind, you know, under the table, they would talk to the Finns first, and the Finns would then tell them, the Russians, what was going on, and vice versa.
Well, let me just have a guess here.
Is that if they join NATO, that's Finnish policy over decades, successful Finnish policy, will have been
I think the idea, if you're going to have a world war, is before that you need to make sure you get rid of all the neutral countries, that they all have to decide which side they're going to be on. You can't have neutral countries.
Well, I think for Finland, I understand where opinion polls are in Finland at the moment, but it's a very poor policy. Finland has always done very well out of not being part of the Western alliance.
Anyway,
so the Russians take a much, you know, the Russians basically regard them as trustworthy interlocutors. There's a reason why Atahari, for example, was brought in to oversee the IRA weapons handover. It's because the Finns have had experience.
Hang on, you've just reminded me.
They know how to manage it.
You've reminded me about Tancred Berenius in World War II. He was the Finnish ambassador to Nazi Germany, and it was him that managed to persuade, or certainly he played a big part in it, managed to persuade the Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy in the Nazi party, to fly off to Britain on that completely ridiculous, silly little journey in his ME-101. And he was arrested and then eventually imprisoned in Spandau jail after the war and died, I think. Well, he was supposed to have committed suicide. Of course, he didn't. He was bumped off just before the fall of the Berlin Wall so that no awkward questions could be asked about Rudolf Hess. So the Finns, at the time, really were working for British intelligence, even though they were supposedly neutral and trusted, even in Germany. Anyway, Martin, I'm going to finish
They weren't neutral. They actually fought on the German side.
Well, that's right. Okay, so John Saws, he's an interesting chap. Not only is he MI6, he's also a Bilderberger. Of course, Bilderberger is supposed to have disappeared, although their fingerprints are all over the COVID scandals, including making fantastic amounts of money out of this CRISPR gene editing therapy, which is partly being used in the new gene therapies that people sometimes miscall vaccines, the mRNA vaccines particularly. They've made a fortune out of that, the Bilderbergs. John Saws is a Bilderberger, but also he has the benefit of being a previous head of MI6. So let's have a listen to what he had to say in Oxford about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And maybe, Martin, you can tell us what you make of his analysis.
One of the things I do in my afterlife from public service is I sit on the board of BP. And you'll have seen the news over the last couple of days of the big decision we took to exit Russia. Now, some might say, well, why were you there in the first place? Well, we were there in the first place because it was a very good investment to make, and it produced excellent returns for shareholders over 25 years, 23 years or something. But it became impossible to be there. And although it was a costly decision, it wasn't a difficult decision because there was no alternative. And we're seeing Equinor followed yesterday. Shell have just followed this evening. I saw in the news before I came in here. The Russian ruble is collapsing, and the level of opposition in Russia is growing. But that said, I think it's important that we leave a way out for Putin from this crisis. If we trap him in a corner and he feels his whole existence is at threat as leader of the Russian regime, then that is a very dangerous time for us all. We saw him fiddling with nuclear alert levels on Sunday, and that was a warning to us. I think it's really important. This is a dangerous time, a dangerous time across Europe. It's really important this doesn't become a conflict between NATO and Russia, and Putin can't turn it into an issue where it looks as though we are battling against Russia. What we're doing is we're supporting Ukraine in its independence and its self-determination and in its sovereignty. And that's the battleground we have to stay on. And it has to be a battleground which, whilst we support the Ukrainian armed forces in their resistance, we do not step across the line and engage Russia directly in conflict, because that would raise the level of tensions and threat vastly higher.
But as we were just discussing, maybe that's what's happened, Martin.
Well, those that you see as an ex-intelligence service chief, I'd make two comments there. The idea that Putin's support is going down is patently wrong. It's just not the case. He had a 63% approval rating before the crisis. It's now 83%. The Russian political class and the ordinary people, especially after the videos circulated of the Ukrainian armed forces torturing their service personnel, they are absolutely up for a fight. So the delusion that somehow the Russians are going to give in because Putin feels weak inside Russia, just wrong. Now, the second part of what he was saying there, let's not push him into a corner. Well, that's all very well, but in actual fact, other people want to push him into a corner. And don't forget, the extreme right in the Ukraine are very keen to push him into a corner to try and start a wider war, because they're losing the one that they've got already. And I just think, how much did we used to pay this guy? Yeah, that is a pitifully weak analysis.
But I mean, isn't it interesting that he's gone on that conveyor belt, the Bilderberg conveyor belt, straight from MI6 into BP,
Shell. When I do my public service, I'm now working for BP. And no doubt getting paid a fair wedge for it as well.
Well, it's not just about the money, is it? It's about the power, but it's about the energy, you know, the energy, the world energy. And I mean, we've seen prices leap. We've seen profits leap in the energy sector. So I bet he's rubbing his hands. He's probably on some massive bonus as well, which he's not talking about to these Oxford students. Anyway, look, he also talks there, Martin, about the nuclear alert level. And this doesn't really get mentioned, I don't think, anywhere near enough, is that the NATO tactics and the Ukrainian army tactics and the general propaganda about Ukraine is pushing further and further towards this potentially very real nuclear exchange. It is quite feasible that something like that may happen if NATO is involved in sinking this Russian flagship. This is exactly the sort of thing that could potentially, even over a very short period of time, escalate things.
Yes. I mean, in many ways, this situation is similar to the run-up to World War One, where everybody's thinking, no, they won't do that, surely not, and then it happens, because everything is pushing in one direction. Now, you hope that there are sensible people on both sides who would prevent that from happening, but the problem is that there's also the desire to escalate. I mean, Biden saying that we're going to overthrow Putin and then having to say, well, I didn't really mean that. But of course, once he said it, Putin knows it. You're not really interested in negotiating anything with us, are you? You just want to get rid of me and everything that I represent. Now, but at the same time, they are still negotiating with the Ukrainians. I come back to the point I made earlier. The Ukrainians, for the first time since 2014 are negotiating with their Russian interlocutors.
Yeah, but it seems to me like they're not really negotiating for anything other than, okay, you can pull your troops out, and then once the troops, Russian troops are pulled out, they send the Nazis in to kill civilians and then try and blame it on the Russians. So,
well, the Russians are basically saying we're not pulling. That withdrawal from Bucha was an agreed withdrawal with the Ukrainians. I mean, there was actually quite severe fighting around Bucha.
And all this talk about chemical weapons in Mariupol as well, we were talking about last week, is ridiculous. The idea that, you know, that you've almost taken a city and that you then would use chemical weapons in that city to get rid of the final people, it's just not going to, it's not the sort of thing the military would do. It's an act of absolute desperation.
They're about
to win. Why would they use chemical weapons? It's just nonsensical. And yet nobody in the Western press,
Martin, they made all this chemical weapons stuff.
Nobody in the Western press questions it at all, even though it makes no military sense whatsoever.
Well, that's right. I mean, people don't need to have specialist knowledge to understand basic facts. And there's, you know, why would they do that? And the answer is they wouldn't, because it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. Anyway,
they wouldn't randomly kill a load of people in Bucha either. Why would they? They're withdrawing in good order because of a political decision. They're not going to go around and shoot a load of people.
This
when
seems
they're doing
to me
that,
like
it?
These
makes sense.
These
they wouldn't do it.
These horrific murders and lies and are being just simply done for the Western press and a bunch of rather useless, naive, green reporters that just are basically stenographers. All they're doing is they're just saying what they're told to say, and they don't ask any questions because that's part of their mindset. Anyway, look, we're going to look now back to 1962, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and to an interview which was done, I think it was in, I suppose, 40 years after that, in 2002, with James Files. He was one of the people who was working with Frank Sturgis on the Bay of Pigs, getting ready to invade Cuba, a little group of insurgents that were being trained in the Florida Everglades. And also, James is one of those people who was implicated in the assassination of JFK, because it was a very similar bunch of people that were involved in that. The Chicago Mafia hitman James Files here describes what he experienced during the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962, and just how real it really was, considering now we have a much more real, many would argue, nuclear chance of a nuclear conflict.
Cuban Missile Crisis, there okay. was no really necessary that blockade.
Everybody was so concerned about going to nuclear war. You know Edwin P. Wilson, right? You've heard of him?
Yeah.
He was with ONI back then, Office of Naval Intelligence. All right, he was pretty tight at that time with Frank Sturgis. But he knew about it. The Naval Intelligence people knew about this when Kennedy went and met Khrushchev, okay? He made an agreement. Nobody in this whole country never knew it, and they didn't want the country to know about it. He made an agreement to take our missiles out of Turkey that time if Khrushchev take his missiles out of Cuba, okay? They agreed to do this. They put the blockade up the whole face. He panicked the whole country into thinking we're going to nuclear war. And as far as I'm concerned,
was made before.
Yeah, the agreement was made before the blockade.
Okay.
Once the blockade was up and the ship's en route, it's too late to do anything. Because they had the one ship, I guess, coming with more missiles, and it pulled up to the blockade, and then they backed off, they turned around, and they went away.
So that was just to save face, to get
those missiles
out of your turn.
There was another farce, just like the Maddox.
Just a deal.
Remember the Maddox?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Another one of those deals there.
Phony deal.
Another phony deal.
How do you know this is true, what you're telling me?
Well, what I heard was, Wilson, he heard it. He got it through the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he had talked with Frank Sturgis about it, and I, Frank, when they was talking, Frank, hey, we need a nuclear war. What do you mean? How do you know? You know, I'm concerned at this point, too.
Yeah.
And then Frank told me. And I says, you're shitting me. And he said, no, I'm serious. I'm telling you how it is. It ain't going to be no nuclear war. Relax. Forget about it. I told my mother, don't worry about it, Mosh. What do you know? You're a kid. What do you know? She heard me swear on the street or something, and a woman is around. She ran out of the house with a broom, chased me up and down the street, beat me with a broom up and down 22nd Avenue.
So that's the voice of James Files there, interviewed in 2002, explaining that the actual deal to pull the American nukes out of Turkey had been done when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and it was really there just to save face. Fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously, I mean, I'd have to listen to that again to get all the detail of what he was saying and whether I agree with it. But it was quite clear. I mean, the way it was presented in the West at the end of it all was that Kennedy had stood firm, the Russians had backed down, and that's how it had happened. But of course, if you watch 11 Days in May, which is based upon the tapes that Kennedy made when he was in the White House, so it's actually, you know, verbatim stuff. The reason they put missiles in Turkey, which were threatening the Soviet Union, same as the missiles in Poland and Romania.
Yeah, and so the point being that it was very, very difficult for the United States to just climb down, pull those missiles out of Turkey. They had to have some sort of incident where the Russians had nearly done the same, and then everything had been defused, and that gave them the political and media credibility, didn't it?
Yeah, but you're missing the point that the Cubans wanted to do something to stop themselves being attacked again. So they were quite keen to have the Russian missiles in there for their own reasons. And in fact, that caused problems in the end game, because Khrushchev had to try and persuade Fidel Castro and Che Guevara that, we're not going through with this. And they were a bit disappointed being, people didn't really. There's an element of kind of surrealism when you're talking about nuclear warfare.
But, I mean, there is another level to Kennedy and the Oval Office in the White House. That's the Office of Naval Intelligence, which he talks about there. So the Navy have got their own ideas about how to deal with all this. Also, he mentions the Maddox incident, which, of course, is also known as the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which triggered the Vietnam War. So what's the significance of that?
Well, I mean, The Maddox incident was a creation of a casus belli against North Vietnam, but it was totally fabricated. And these are the people who tell us to believe every word they say about what's going on in Ukraine, even though they've got a track record as long as your arm of telling lies and creating psychological warfare fantasies. What I find extraordinary now is that the psychological warfare fantasists have now almost come out of the closet. They're prancing around in high heels and going on about how they're winning the war in Ukraine by telling lies. I mean, they've actually briefed that that's what they're doing. I mean, I've sent the stuff around, Tony. I mean, they've already confessed up to it. And people are watching the mainstream media, and the mainstream media are being fed. You'd have thought somebody should be saying we need independent, objective analysis of a war. We need to know who's winning, who's losing,
but I'm afraid
how many tanks have been destroyed.
Yeah, all right.
But we're being fed
When it comes to wartime, those old journalistic rule books apparently are torn up. Did Jim Morrison's father inadvertently start the Vietnam War Far Out magazine? Is it literally a week or two, couple of weeks ago, a story a couple of weeks ago on there? I think it was forced, if I was forced to name, the writer says, one of the most surprising examples of hippie hypocrisy, it would have to be Jim Morrison, a notorious opponent of the Vietnam War, who was the son of the man who not only served in the conflict, but played an important part in starting it. So Jim Morrison's father was actually the admiral who was in charge of the fleet at the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yes, well, when Jim Morrison was at the height of his fame, he was asked, "Do you have a father?" He said, "I have no father." And if you actually listen to the songs, it's all about, killing his father and raping his mother
I don't think that's... Well, look, the way I take it is that his father wasn't happy about the way that he was used to start that war. And so, obviously, he's talking to his family, he's talking to others around him, saying, look, you know, this is the way things really work, which is great. This is why, his son, Jim Morrison, the singer, the Doors, the band, were opposing the Vietnam War, partly because they knew the whole thing was a setup, a bit like Julian Assange is constantly pointing out. The only way these wars can get started is if we allow our mass media to lie to us.
Well, I've read very interesting stuff that suggests that Jim Morrison's father was the person who rescued the USS Liberty in 1967, because it was under attack by the Israelis, supposedly to blame the Egyptians and then bring the US into
the
war.
Well, that's right. He, I think, and this was published in the Telegraph Silurian column, gosh, must be a decade ago now, that he actually ordered an airstrike on the Israeli air bases where the aircraft came from that hit the Liberty.
No, well, as I understand,
he did order an airstrike, but it was countermanded by Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah,
but
at that point, the Israelis, you see, what the Israelis wanted to do is sink the ship with all hands, and then there'd be no witnesses. But because of Jim Morrison's father's intervention, they couldn't do that. And the thing has been a running sore ever since, because the Israelis were attacking a US spy ship in order to provoke a war. Now, this kind of provocational behavior is ingrained in Western military thinking.
But what about
they've
the fact that we're now...
I mean, they just don't know how to do anything else.
Martin, would you agree that we're now actually in a much more dangerous situation than we were in 1962?
Yes, because the West has ripped up the Intermediate Forces Nuclear Forces Treaty in Europe, and the Russians undoubtedly feel that they are threatened by short-range missiles in Europe. Now, the answer to that in 1962 was for them to send some short-range missiles to Cuba. They still might do that, but I think the reason they won't do it is because it puts a target on Cuba and on Venezuela or Nicaragua if they were to join in on that.
What might be the motive of NATO, if it was NATO, behind the sinking of this Russian flagship?
Well, it's obvious that NATO wants the Russians, the Ukrainians would be happy to have sunk it. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And since we're supporting the Ukrainians, then the NATO bigwigs would be happy that we've sunk it. But the problem is that they want to be happy that they've sunk it, but they don't want to admit that they had anything to do with it, because then the Russians might do the same. I mean, this is the thing. You can do this. Yes, we've sunk the Russian ship. And then the Russians say, right, now we'll sink your ship. What are you going to do now?
Well,
and then, of course, it starts going up the escalation.
It certainly can. Anyway, one of the people who was involved in the assassination of JFK, you just heard from James Files there, who was in the Chicago Mafia, in the Chicago mob. He was one of the people that came down the guy that fired the fatal shot that killed US President John F. Kennedy in 1963. His controller at the Central Intelligence Agency was a guy called David Attlee Phillips, and who was also the controller for the Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Oswald played a kind of peripheral role. He was there to aid the shooters and that sort of thing, and keep an eye on them for the CIA. Alan Frankovich, we were talking about last week quite a bit, Martin. There's, I think, a fascinating interview with him, which we can replay at some point, which is on Alternative Views, which I've just put up on my Odyssey channel. Frankovich, one of the greatest filmmakers, documentary filmmakers ever, died under suspicious circumstances, age, I think, in his mid-50s, in the customs hall at Houston George W. Bush Airport. David Attlee Phillips was actually interviewed by Frankovich for his film On Company Business. So let's have a listen to the guy who was a CIA controller for both the Grassy Knoll shooter, James Files, with his Remington Fireball that blew away the President John F. Kennedy in 1963, as well as Lee Harvey Oswald, who was the patsy. Who is this guy? What does he sound like? Here he is on Alan Frankovich's film. David Attlee Phillips talking about and explaining the difficult job that he has as an intelligence officer for the CIA.
Are the people in Chile better off now than they were under Allende?
What you've done is pose the dilemma that people who are in clandestine operations must face many times during their life. Sometimes these practitioners have problems of personal ethics and morality. Am I doing something that's not really good for the people? Furthermore, I've noted in intelligence operations that usually we've gotten into trouble when we've tried to help people who didn't really want to be helped very much. What it boils down to is it really something in our national interest that must be done? In the past, in the atmosphere of the Cold War, and even in the 60s, the American public, without question, felt that their presidents should go ahead and be firm on things like this and be sure that our interests around the world were stoutly defended. That's beginning to change to some degree. But I'm afraid it all goes back to that Oval Office in the White House and the kind of decisions that are made there, the perceptions that are made there. Otherwise, an intelligence organization or a practitioner of intelligence finds himself in the position of, I don't like this. It really shouldn't be done. My personal opinion is that it's wrong. What do you do then? Do you resign in protest?
Mr. Kissinger, during the time under review, was the president's advisor on international security affairs and then became the Secretary of State. So we needed his testimony to determine what the administration policy was toward Chile in this particular period. His presence here should not be interpreted as meaning that he himself was ever involved in any plot to assassinate any foreign figure.
Well, of course, Kissinger was involved, very much involved, and that's a terrific bit of film there, included in Alan Frankovich's On Company Business, which came out in 1980, a three-hour-long film all about the Central Intelligence Agency's role post-Second World War. And before that, so that was Senator Church talking with a very guilty-looking Henry Kissinger stood next to him, hovering. And before that, it was David Attlee Phillips, who's a CIA officer who was the controller for both James Files, who did some work with the CIA, although his main job was as a hitman for the Chicago Mafia, and also for Lee Harvey Oswald, who was the patsy for the assassination, trying to make out that it was some sort of Russian connection with the murder, rather ham-fisted approach. And of course, he was murdered in police whilst he was in police custody. I think a brilliant, one of the greatest of all time filmmakers, Alan Frankovich, Martin. But look, what we're talking about here is something particularly nasty going on in the United States, maybe Nazi even, after the Second World War. And it does seem as if many of the Nazis were brought into the US at the end of the World War II. And that in some ways today, we've got a really dangerous version of Nazi Germany in the United States, where the attacks around the world, I mean, they seem to be up for invading whatever country they feel like, rather like the Nazis did in the late 1930s.
Well, there's clearly a very strong Nazi intelligence influence in the setting up of the NATO intelligence structures in the 1940s. But that's because the Anglo, Zionist, as it then became, intelligence structure has been dominant for many, many years anyway. In the 1930s, they basically groomed Hitler, didn't they? You can see that the rational people who are in charge in China and Russia have reached the point where they realise that they're going to have to stand up to these people because somebody has to, and they're
know a lot of this, won't they? And I always ask the question: who is in charge really? Is it the Brits or is it the Americans or is it the Israelis? Because there always seems to be a sort of, I mean, we heard just there, didn't we, from James Files we've heard, and from Alan Frankovich, we've heard that the whole setup is that if something goes wrong, the CIA, if the CIA are blamed, as Attlee Phillips talks about there, they can just blame the White House, saying, oh, well, it's all down to the White House. If the White House gets the blame, they just say, oh, no, it's all the CIA. And we see similar things going on around the world, particularly between Britain, the United States and Israel, where if one of them looks as if it's blamed, then they will put the blame onto somebody else. But anyway, John Loftus has written a terrific book called The Secret War on the Jews, and I interviewed him a few years ago, but I thought I'd take a little extract, it's just a few minutes, where he talks about what was really going on with the Nazis in after the Second World War and the creation of the CIA, particularly the role of the Dulles brothers. I wonder, Martin, if you could just, before we hear from John Loftus, what you think about the relationship between post-war relationship between Britain and America, and who's really in charge of them out of those two?
I mean, ostensibly, Britain is the junior partner in every possible way you can think. But as a junior partner, they punch above their weight. Don't forget the City of London and Wall Street are very important and intertwined institutions. So in a sense, Britain is an honorary part of the US. I mean, that's clearly where Johnson and people around him are coming from. And the Israelis, a country the size of Wales, as people say, they punch well above their weight. But ultimately, of course, the real power is the United States and its allies, which includes comprador elites in other countries, particularly in Israel and Britain.
Yeah, okay, so we're here from John Loftus now, looking at the particularly the allied Nazis, the Dulles brothers, and particularly also he focuses, that's over in the United States, and he also focuses on the role of Edward VIII, the British king that abdicated.
The Dulles brothers were wiretapped by the British before America's entry into World War II, showing that the Dulles brothers were actively helping the Nazis. John Foster Dulles, for example, was on the board of IG Farben. They had negotiated a stock swap with the Rockefeller's Standard Oil. So next to the Rockefellers, this Nazi company, IG Farben, was the second largest shareholder. So there was, you know, a cross-investment going on. So the Dulles brothers were traitors. They were giving aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war. But they represented some of the more powerful families of Wall Street, what they used to call the robber barons. And it's sad to say what happened. You know, 99% of Americans, you know, thought Hitler was a bad guy. 1% thought that he was a moneymaker.
What about the British, though? Because there were quite a lot of pro-Nazis in the UK, not least of which the former king, Edward VIII. I wonder if you came across any documents that throw light upon some of the Hitler's supporters in Britain.
Oh, I did. That's why one of my books, The Secret War Against the Jews, would never be touched by a British publisher, because it told the truth. I read Windsor's file.
This is Windsor Castle, His Royal Highness Prince Edward.
You must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. I now quit altogether public affairs, and I lay down my burden. It may be some time before I return to my native land, but I shall always follow the fortunes of the British race and empire with profound interest. And if at any time in the future I can be found of service to His Majesty, I shall not fail.
He did not resign to marry the woman he loved. He resigned because he was wiretapped by British intelligence of having private communications with Hitler's ambassador to London and Ribbentrop. Windsor was saying, look, we're not going to interfere with Germany's plans to take over the Alsace problem. We're not going to interfere with the Jews or anything else. So, you know, contrary to British law, this guy was making foreign policy of a secret alliance with Hitler. Now, he did this because his mistress, later his wife, was a Nazi intelligence agent. Now, when J. Edgar Hoover wrote to President Roosevelt saying, look, Windsor has to, it was not enough when Windsor was forced to abdicate. Hoover wanted him imprisoned because he was a dangerous Nazi agent. And Churchill said, no, please don't do that, because we have other members of the royal family who are involved and many members of the British establishment. Let's just keep a lid on this. So they put him down in Bahamas the duration of the war. But yeah, he was a terrible man. He literally sold out the French defense plans and Belgian defense plans for the Maginot Line, which enabled the Nazis to do an end run. Terrible guy.
What about Martin Bormann? I wonder if you've come across him.
Bormann was the guy that got the Western investors to back the Nazi party. And he knew that what Hitler was doing was really ridiculously crazy to try and fight a war on both fronts. I remember reading the Nazi ambassador's top secret file record from Nuremberg, where he said it wasn't just Windsor, there was also Ramsay MacDonald was also not entirely unsympathetic to Nazi views. So there's a whole clique of very powerful people in Britain who were on the enemy side. And, you know, Windsor was actually saying to Hitler, go ahead and keep up the bombing on Britain. The people are about to break. And then my crowd will come in and, you know, you'll restore me as the first fascist king of England.
So he was hoping to come back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, after he resigned, he was given a job with the military as a general to inspect, you know, defenses in Europe. And all he did was pass all the top secret French and British plans to Hitler.
That's John Loftus there, bless him, a fantastic writer and researcher. He was given a special prosecutor status under the Jimmy Carter government in the 1970s, and had access to all of the most secret US intelligence files on all these people. Fascinating bloke to get the inside story, as we did with Harry Beckhoff, bless him too, who passed away a few years ago, the longest serving member of the Conservative Party, used to live in Marlborough on this show, even ferried him down here one evening, on one Friday evening, to the City Academy here in Bristol, to go, run through a 2 hours of, and he did a fantastic job, I think he was 97 at the time, of running through that week's local, national and international news, Harry. But he explained to us that when he was working for MI6 in the Second World War, that he'd seen the files where actually Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson had tried to get across enemy lines and get into Germany. So that would have been a bit of a propaganda victory for the Germans if they'd had a former British king broadcasting and cheering on the troops. But anyway, no, he was stopped by MI6 at the time, and that's after that he was sent over to Bermuda. But Martin, lots of these Nazis, it seems, not just the American ones, but in Britain too, actually supporting Hitler, thinking that actually the fascist ideals, the master race stuff, etc., was a great way of keeping down the poor and the workers.
Well, that's right. And I think with, you know, this historical orientation is well understood inside modern Russia, which is why they are very, very sensitive about the Ukrainian fascist right wing. And they're also, of course, very worried about short range nuclear weapons pointed point blank at them. And it's not surprising that they have reacted in the way that they have.
Not at all. Okay, so we're going to wind up this week with one of my favourite writers. I don't think we've ever had audio from him on this show. I think he's passed away now. His name's Jim Keith. He wrote a fantastic book called Rule by Secrecy back in the 1990s. I can remember reading that around about 2000 and being blown away by it, really. An incredible bloke. And here he is talking on the Jeff Rentz show about one of the things that we always touching again and again on this program, which is media mind control, but particularly this whole idea of MK Ultra, what that was really about, what happened, and who was behind it.
At Ravenscraig, you and Cameron did experimentation on people who were completely unwitting, had not given permission to be experimented upon, and he would put them into deep sleep for sometimes as long as 200 days, completely drug them out, use what was called psychic driving, in which a command tape loop was played again and again and again for hour after hour after hour, and essentially reduce these people to the condition of vegetables. Now, this was all officially done to be therapeutic. However, apparently no one ever noticed any therapeutic results of turning person after person after person into vegetables. It was like a conveyor belt for creating zombies, just to find out what kind of mind control could be done.
Yeah, indeed. The movie The Manchurian Candidate, said to have been basically made to disappear for about 2 decades, wasn't around, couldn't find it.
Yeah, you know, I believe it was Frank Sinatra who had that pulled, because he thought the issue of mind control was rather touchy at the time of the JFK assassination. There was a lot of speculation that Lee Harvey Oswald was mind controlled. In fact, the director of the CIA at that time issued a memo suggesting that Oswald had been mind controlled by the Russians. There are a lot of mind control underpinnings connected to the JFK assassination, but since it was a lone assassin, I laugh up my sleeve. That stuff is kind of irrelevant.
Did you just say what I think you said?
I laugh up my sleeve. You know, it's obvious that it wasn't a lone assassin.
Okay, yes, I got it. I hadn't heard the up the sleeve line in a while. Another name, Tavistock.
Yeah, the Tavistock Institute was established. It depends on whether you believe the cover story or not. The buzz is it was established around 1921, but in the official literature, it supposedly started around 1930. But what this was a collaboration between the psychiatric establishment and the military establishment of England. And it's remarkable. A great deal of the broad mind control projects and so forth, which have been instituted since those early days, have come out of this collaboration of military intelligence and psychiatry. Tavistock is an amazing nexus of world control, let's put it that way.
Well, so this whole idea of mind control, it's actually, I think there's lots and lots goes on, Martin, isn't there? Don't you agree with, particularly with the, I mean, we're in this world now where we've got a very different world to around the time, so even the end of the Second World War, with mass TV all over the planet, in all the developed countries. Obviously, there's quite a lot of people who are picking up TV on social media on their phones, on their mobile devices, so that this stuff can spread right across the world almost instantaneously. Whether it's true or not, well, that's a whole other question. But then you've also got the spread of nuclear weapons too, so it's a completely different world that we're living in today.
Well, it's completely different in the sense that it's an iteration of what went before, and it's getting worse all the time. I mean, you know, if you think about mind control, the stuff in Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, shows how the idea of mind control developed after the Korean War, because various POWs, British and American, basically went on North Korean TV to say that they were in the wrong and we shouldn't be attacking Korea. And, of course, it was believed that they'd somehow been brainwashed. In actual fact, it's quite straightforward. They were conscripts, mainly. They didn't know where they were or what they were doing there. And the North Koreans just give them some better food and say, well, you go on telly and tell everybody.
Anyway,
they did. Yeah, so there was no mind control.
Jim Keith was also very good, I think. And this is our final clip tonight, where he explains the sort of mentality behind MKUltra, behind the mentality behind this idea that you can use television, you can use whatever it happens to be, maybe even by targeting a specific individual and hypnotizing them to get what you want.
You know, what my book is about is kind of a history of mind control and all of these different fabrics that are intertwined to sort of create a straitjacket for the society. And in terms of the psychiatric establishment, you look at their motives and you look at their history, and it is entirely materialistic. It goes back not to get too arcane here, but it goes back to the late 19th century and the German-Prussian system, both of education and of psychology. And their whole thesis was that man is an animal, man has no spirit, and that the correct orientation is to grant the state complete control, and the individual is simply a cogwheel. And I believe psychiatry has furthered that agenda for the entirety of this century through groups, for instance, like the Nazis, through funding by the Rockefellers, through the horrible experimentation of the CIA. In fact, psychiatry and the Prussian school system, which we have, it was always oriented towards keeping the person down, socializing, meaning robotizing them. I don't see that as a healthy thing.
No, who does? Jim Keith there, died aged around about 50, prematurely. I mean, the Wikipedia entry for him is a bit of a joke. Well, it's disgusting, really. It just says, oh, he was interested in black helicopters and conspiracy theories. No, Jim was one of the best analysts of the whole idea of keeping the real rulers secret behind the scenes, behind the curtain, like the Wizard of Oz, one of the best writers there's ever been. So he's, the two particular books that I'd recommend are not mentioned by Wikipedia, of course, are The One Ruled by Secrecy, and then also Mind Control, World Control. So that's just revisiting Jim at the end of the show for Good Friday this year, this week. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. And when it's not such a busy Easter week, then I'll try to read them. Sorry about missing a couple of your emails this week, Martin. And where you'll find also the podcast, the full-length interviews this week, the one with Len Lawrence, particularly interesting, looking at how he was having a good old chat with Jeffrey Cox about a massive class action against the airliner manufacturers, and then Jeffrey Cox gets booted out. And also story links, the comment page, and our email addresses. So you can also subscribe to my weekly email list there if you wish. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. The website is thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, that glorious Fourth Reich or Fourth Industrial Revolution. So you can restream us live if you can, or rebroadcast us. Just let me know and I'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable Easter weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
We'd like to tell you a story about a young girl, about 18 years old, about 5'2", and about to go out. Now her mother, realizing it was her first time out with a young man, called her into the bedroom and said, "Minnie, you're all dressed up in your finery, your very best clothes, and you look beautiful. You're gorgeous. You're alluring.
You look swell, baby.
And now, Minnie, I want you to remember everything I've always told you. And above all, I want you to be very, very careful."
But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. She didn't take her mother's good advice. Now there aren't so many girls today who have one. And she'd never let it go for any price. They searched the place from penthouse to the cellar, in every room and underneath each bed. Once they thought they saw it lying on a pillow, but they found it belonged to someone else instead. But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. She didn't know exactly whom to blame, and she couldn't say just how or when she lost it. She only knew she had it when she came. They questioned all the bellboys and the porter. The chef appeared to be the guilty guy. And the doorman also acted quite suspicious. But he coyly said, "I'm sure it wasn't I." But she had to go and lose it at the Astor. It nearly killed her mother and her dad. Now they felt as bad about the thing as she did. After all, it was the only one she had. They just about completed all their searching when the chauffeur walked up with it in his hand. All they did was stand and gape. There was Minnie's sable cape, and she thought that she had lost it at the Astor.